Hello and welcome to Legendary Games, the podcast where we celebrate the designers behind iconic games. I'm thrilled to introduce our guest today, Jason Matthews, one of the two brilliant minds behind Twilight Struggle. For several years, Twilight Struggle has held the coveted top spot on Board Game Geek, and as we celebrate its 20th anniversary in 2025, we are very happy to have you on the show, Mr. Matthews.
It's my pleasure. Thank you both, Dominic and Alex, for inviting me on. It's exciting.
Yeah, we're staying with first names, and you already told the audience that we have a co-host with me, and Alexander, you may say some words as well.
Yeah, hello. Also from my side, we're very happy to have you here in our little show. Jason, you're one of the very successful board game developers of our time, and I have one question in advance for you. We have had some guys and developers here in our little podcast. For example, a guy named Larry Harris. I'm quite sure you have heard that name before. He was answering all our questions, but there were some kind of questions on which he said, you know what, I maybe not be the right person to answer this because I consider myself a pure game developer and an inventor and not really a hardcore gamer. So that was a little surprise for us. And the question for you would be, how would you describe yourself in that position? Do you have a big gaming background, or are you also considering yourself, I started game design early and then I stick to it?
I'm a little surprised to hear that, honestly. I am exactly the opposite. I mean, I'm first and foremost a nerd, and I played games for many, many years before I ever attempted to design one. And even still, for my own design process, I think it's very important for me to see what other designers are doing and try and keep pace with the state of the art. That includes things that don't have anything to do with wargaming. I mean, I play a lot of Euro games. I play a lot of computer games. If you've got a really interesting role-playing game, I might even give it a whirl just to see the mechanics of it. And so I take the opposite philosophy, to be honest.
That's interesting because it's the complete opposite of him. He doesn't look left or right. He's just having something in mind and some ideas which develop to a game, but he's not looking for any other games of designers. So when we have asked him about some other famous war games, he was polite, but he didn't know too much about them.
Well, you'll be able to ask me all those questions.
I'll be happy to answer.
Perfect. So my first question would be, what was the first game that truly captivated you and why?
My first important gaming experience, my family had already, we played Risk and all of the classical family games, and I played chess and I was semi-serious about games that way. But the real hobby experience that drove my involvement in what would become the gaming hobby was Axis and Allies from Larry Harris. And my father, I didn't ask for it. I didn't even know it existed, but he saw Axis and Allies and Toys R Us the year it came out from Milton Bradley and knew that I was like a history nerd kid. And brought it home. And then we played every weekend for years and years. And so not only was it this important introduction to the hobby for me, but it was an important bonding moment between my dad, who is otherwise kind of a man's man type, bricklayer, blah, 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 and me, the nerdy little history kid. So I'm very grateful to Larry Harris for that experience. But that was my introduction to wargaming.
So just having great hours within the family and having a special bond with your father, spending time.
Precisely.
So your passion for board gaming, especially wargaming, was initiated by playing Axis and Allies, I guess the classic version.
Yes. Larry Harris published an earlier version that used chits, kind of more classical wargame looking production. But yes, I had that first plastic Milton Bradley edition.
I was playing Shogun in 1990 or something. That was my first contact with the Milton Bradley games. And I had later on Conquest of the Empire, which was designed by Larry Harris as well, and Axis and Allies. But you have invented something which is kind of an evolution of the wargaming. The classic wargames that were done by Larry Harris worked differently than those who came with your entry in the game designing world, and that's what we are going to focus on today. So what kind of designers have influenced you when you were developing your first major game?
So I guess what we were doing, Ananda and I were doing, is an accumulation of a lot of gaming experience. And both of us had been serious war gamers. I'd played a lot of what we call monster war games that take multiple days to play. And you have to lay out the maps over a whole basement and continue on playing for weeks. And I think I hit a little bit of a brick wall with wargaming. And right at that time, that's when Eurogames first started being introduced into the United States. And so I was going to law school in Chicago, and Mayfair, which is an American game publisher, was the first company to bring over Settlers of Catan and a couple of other bureaus in that year. And since I was in the same state as them, I would run into them at conventions, and I got to play Settlers of Catan very early. And my mind was blown that you could have a kind of a strategic experience with multiple players and have it be over in an hour and a half compared to the 12-hour marathons that we had been playing before without ending. So both Ananda and I had had that experience. We both ended up playing a ton of Euro games. And at the same time, there started to be a little bit of renaissance in wargame design. And that was brought on most explicitly by Mark Herman, who was the first person to design what we call card-driven war games, which is to say that it's not just hex and counters. You usually have a deck of cards. That deck of cards will ordinarily represent both important historical events that impact a battle or a campaign or a war, and the political element of warfare, which most war games had either politely ignored or had created a very clunky set of rules around. So Ananda and I, in terms of major influences, were both reacting to Mark Herman because he's the first one who tried to do this. Both of us were big fans of Paths of Glory, which was a World War I card-driven game that had come out shortly before Twilight Struggle. And then we're stealing wildly from other European designers who'd done clever, interesting things. For me, Martin Wallace was a huge influence. Martin Wallace also likes to play in this light historical space quite a bit, or used to. There were ideas that I had taken from Alan Boone's European games, and things like History of the World, which is a Ragnar Brothers design that came at the end of Avalon Hill. Kind of the scoring system of Twilight Struggle is reflective of things that we observed from that. The Ragnar Brothers are designers in the UK. So again, sitting on that weird cross point between European influence and American style war game design.
Yeah, but you picked out a lot of different systems from games which were entertaining, had a certain depth, had a lot of communication, which is Settler of Catan, and had a good length of playing it in one evening. And you found the right ingredients to create something new out of it or something revolutionary. The first card-driven war game I remember was Hannibal versus Rome, which was Mark Simonich.
Exactly.
And that was mid of the 90s, released by Avalon Hill. But we played that after we have played Twilight Struggle. So I know that it's older and it's also a good game, but that would be the first one I would state as a 90s card-driven war game that I remember.
It's a great game for sure. And the new edition is very lovely.
Twilight Struggle is an evolution of that concept. You can see that very well and took very many good ideas. Like, for example, Hannibal does not have the opponent's event system, that you cannot play an event of the opponent without having any damage for it. And if I got your answer right, you would say that maybe the process of playing more and more advanced war games has somehow driven you into becoming a game designer somehow.
The most immediate thing, before Board Game Geek had become kind of the place where all gamers of all sorts congregated, there was something called Consim World. It still exists, but it's more like a message board where people go into different folders and they talk with other gamers about particular games or with particular companies.
Die Hard platform.
Yeah, right. Ananda, my co-designer on Twilight Struggle, had been very active there and had gotten involved with playtesting for GMT. So he started bringing games back and I was his playtest opponent. And the difficulty was we had admired Paths of Glory, but Paths of Glory was about 8 hours to play. And both of us were entering the stage where we had real jobs, we were married, we were starting to have kids, normal life things. And the games he was bringing back were not 8 hours, now they're 12 hours, now they're 14 hours. And it was going in exactly the wrong direction for our own lives. And that's what made us say, wait, 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 the hobby's going in the wrong direction for us. We need to push this way back. Now, our three-hour design for most Euro gamers seems like it's a slog and very long, but we were trying to do the exact opposite thing. We were really trying to shorten play time so that people could get in a serious gaming experience in a single evening.
That's easy to understand.
I think that's a really big problem that you ignore the time. You were talking about Mark Herman, and he has designed some brilliant games like Churchill or Versailles 1919, where you are really negotiating peace treaties or after World War II orders. But the biggest problem is that he has done games like War in the Pacific, and you know they are 160 hours, so I have no idea who can ever play them without having anything else in his life. So that contradicts a bit the approach, in my opinion. So that's the fascinating point about having Twilight Struggle, a very deep game, which can be played in a relatively short time for a wargamer. And that's brilliant. But you were already talking about Mr. Ananda Gupta, and you were saying you have met him on the forum. So when did you meet in real life for the first time?
To be clear, we already knew each other. Yeah. I just happened to be active in the forums. But we met at a gaming club here in Washington, D.C. And weirdly enough, we're from the same place in California, and we went to the same game store in California. We didn't know each other there. We met here.
That's a funny story. Coincidentally, you could have met years earlier.
Yes, indeed.
Going back to the point where you're discovering that your hobby was going the wrong direction and you want to change something, tell us about the steps you were taking from having the idea about how to change something to becoming a developer, contacting publishers, developing the ideas in your garage, how to do a board game.
Since we had already playtested for a company, we were lucky enough to at least know who to talk to. So that's a big step. We weren't totally pitching in the dark. We had a little bit of a slight head start there. And initially, Ananda and I had decided that we were going to do the Spanish Civil War because there weren't a lot of games at the time on that subject. We thought that card-driven games were very good for conflicts with a heavy political component. And the Spanish Civil War certainly has that. But when I started reading about the Spanish Civil War, I realized that I could probably spend the rest of my life reading about the Spanish Civil War and still not fully understand the political nuances of the Spanish Civil War. And I had to be like, Ananda, I think this is maybe a dead end. And so I think it was Ananda who said, well, what about the Cold War? And I'm like, yeah, that's fantastic because I'm old enough to have remembered the back end of it.
And you grew up with it.
Yeah, I grew up with it. And if you're doing political science in the 1980s, all you're really studying is the Cold War and everything sort of relates back to the Cold War. And so after we decided on that, the design itself came very quickly. It was more of a question of what we were going to leave out than what we were going to include.
We're going to ask that later, why certain events haven't been in the game, and we can explain it by ourselves a little bit for some events. But that's interesting what kind of events you had in mind, which were dropped out.
We actually have little rules to it that I still kind of enforce, although they've been broken once or twice, so whatever.
You may share them with us. So my question would be, the initial spark of Twilight Struggle is the chat with your friend Ananda Gupta, and you were talking about, hey, we're going to do a game, but what kind of setting do we use? And I think having the Cold War setting is a brilliant setting. Coming back to Larry Harris, I was proposing him, like, do the 30 years of war in Germany, 1618 to 1648, because you have France, you have Sweden, you have Austria, you have all those little states like Saxony, and you have the Netherlands, and you can do Protestants versus Catholics, so you have a different level. And he said, yeah, but that's not a commercial success. People know about Napoleon, people know about Stalingrad when I want to do something in Europe, but no one cares for Westphalian peace. So he said that's not a commercial approach for him to have a successful game. So that was interesting for me, hearing it by the designer, because I think the Spanish Civil War is very special, but you have a much bigger audience or a much bigger target group if you're doing something like a Cold War scenario.
Two things about that specifically. First of all, just for the record, I was told by multiple European publishers after Twilight Struggle was a success in the United States, it come out, it wasn't in any other language, but I was told specifically by German publishers that they could never do Twilight Struggle in Germany and would never sell in Europe. So my own personal take on it is that if the game is good, it will sell. I don't understand what is appealing about medieval agriculture, but Agricola, it's a fantastic game, and it doesn't matter that collecting reeds is a boring activity. The game is fun. And I think if Larry were to design a game on the Peace of Westphalia or the 30 Years' War or the 7 Years' War or any of the other multiple party European wars that most Americans don't know anything about, it won't matter if the game is cool and they're cool little miniatures and, you know, it's rolling dice and you're having a fun time.
Yeah, he's leaving the field wide open to you now, so you have that background info now. But regarding the miniatures, if you're talking about games of GMT, it's always the chits and it's always lower production compared to the old Milton Bradley games or to the deluxe versions, which are on GameFound or Kickstarter. So do you prefer this more informational design or do you think it's also nice to upgrading the game with some flavor, having small figures?
After I discovered Axis and Allies, the second thing that happened to me in the hobby is a major convention. It was called Origins. It still exists, but at one point in time, it was the most important board gaming convention in the country. And while it had classically been in Baltimore on the East Coast, they decided they were going to rotate it around the United States. And just at random, it showed up in Los Angeles. And I found a flyer for it somewhere. And I was looking for more Axis and Allies, basically, but I walked into Origins instead. And the first thing I did was go into the main hall and a humongous Napoleonic battle, and they were playing it at what looked like 1-to-1 scale. And it took up a gigantic table with the most beautiful terrain you'd ever seen. And after I saw it, I was like, I am going to do that for the rest of my life. So I went out and I bought a bunch of miniatures and I started painting Russians and Poles and Frenchmen. And so to answer your question in the long way, I love toys and I love them in a board game that I want to play with. So I understand why GMT does what it does. In their defense, they have been very much focused on improving their graphic design as of late, and they'll put cubes in games and whatnot, but they haven't gotten to the point where they're doing stylized wooden pieces or whatever.
Yeah.
But the other company I'm involved with, Fort Circle Games, does do that. Like, they carved out little woman suffragettes for their game on the right to vote for women in the United States. So he and I both share that love of toys and love of interesting components and bits.
That's nice to hear. I would be also glad if the GMT games would release every game with a mounted map. That would be also a progress, because being a first edition owner, having the clarifications and knowing that if it's a success, the next one comes up with a mounted map, I'm always like, yeah, why should I buy the first edition? That's always the biggest issue for me, having not a real guarantee of playing on a mounted map. But I completely understand it, because the volume of the games which they are releasing, P500 system, is already kind of small, and I can understand those compromises pretty well out of an economic view. And the only thing I would always be a bit discomfortable is having those cheap maps.
Especially when you're playing Paths of Glory and you have the folded thing exactly at the Western Front.
I share all of those frustrations as a consumer. I mean, obviously, the folks at GMT are my friends, and I have done exactly the thing that you are describing, but I have become such a snob about it. If I find out if it's a game that even I'm interested in and it's not on a mounted map, I will normally wait to get it to see if it's going to end up with a mounted map edition.
So in talking about your friends at GMT, how did you get in contact with GMT, and how did the relationship process?
As I mentioned, since we were playtesting for them, we at least knew their names. I didn't know them, although ironically, they're a California company. So again, I might have met them earlier, but I just didn't. So there is a major convention here called World Board Game Championship. Much like the World Series, it's probably misleading because there aren't very many foreigners participating. But it was originally called Avalon Con, which had been started by Don Greenwood, who was an old Avalon Hill employee. Well, initially it was started while Avalon Hill was still going, but they kept it going as a kind of a tribute to the old Avalon Hill company in wargaming. So GMT always came to that convention. So we knew that once we had a prototype, we could go to the World Board Gaming Championship and show it to them there. And we were just lucky because we showed it to Andy Lewis, who is a friend now, and he took the design and he took it over to Gene. And he's like, yeah, I just got this thing on the Cold War. I don't think we should do it, but take a look. But Gene loves the Cold War. And he was like, yes, we're doing it. And so we were kind of off to the races. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you need a bit luck. So we were already talking about, you had the idea doing a board game. You were talking to Mr. Gupta and he said, yeah, what about the Cold War? And then you had scenario. So in which years did that happen? And how did you divide the tasks you had for developing the game?
Twilight Struggle was published in 25. I think the time we decided we were going to do a design until we had some kind of workable prototype at WBC, that was about a year. And then, as I say, GMT decided relatively quickly that they were going to do it and put it on the P500, but it just kind of languished there for a long time. We were two new designers. No one knew who we were or why they should want to play this game. So it didn't exactly rocket up the P500 list. In terms of the way we worked through the design process, the actual manufacturer, it was very much a meet for a week, decide what needed to be done, split the tasks between Ananda and I, and then meet again next week, play again, decide what needs to be done, split the tasks, then meet again the week after. And we just continued doing that till we had a playable design. Between the prototype and when the game was finally published, Ananda took a job, and his new job had these intellectual property limitations. It was like a computer game company that had some very serious restrictions on things that came out of his brain. And so for that reason, I mostly spent the years between it was published and when they agreed to do it, playing and fixing the cards through one iteration after another, just going to conventions. We didn't have the electronic resources to do this kind of playtesting at the time. So this was all just finding human beings willing to try it at conventions.
Would you say that concept of refining the game rules over and over, how much time did you spend in it? Because the balancing of Twilight Struggle is just excellent. And the next question would be, was that process more like fun or more like work or both?
I think the game was definitely improved by the fact that I had this long period of time to continue to refine it. And of course, since we were both new at it, we still made plenty of mistakes. And the designs that came after, even 1960, which is close after, but I learned so much from Twilight Struggle. 1960 is a much cleaner, fewer errata, much less problematic to my work-life balance design than Twilight Struggle was. It didn't really feel like work at the time because I was so excited to have a game coming out and I was excited to work on it. That iterative process that I do think is necessary, certainly in card-driven games where sometimes you change one card and it has all these cascading impacts on other cards and then you have to change all of those cards and you uncover some other problem that you've just created. That feels like work for sure, but it is a necessary part of game design, particularly if you're going to interweave mechanisms and interweave cards. I think that interlaced design is fun to play and kind of hard work to design.
I agree. If you're having a battle deck and the cards are influencing each other, it's difficult to sort it out if it's 1 point, 2 point, 3 point, 4 point, or the event itself. So you will have to go over it to keep it balanced. And I think that's what you brilliantly did on Twilight Struggle. But being a nobody, and you said you were starting slow on the P500 list, becoming the best sold game ever for GMT. But I was reading a story in the Washington Post that Alan R. Moon was playing your game and that he has really made it coming over the hump. So is that true? And can you share that story with us?
Yeah, that's exactly true.
So Alan Moon runs a convention called The Gathering, and I was essentially a hobby nobody, but I wrote reviews and that sort of thing. And so some people knew who I was, and I got an invitation to The Gathering. And so I got to know Alan Moon there, and we were kind of friends. And I should say also, I never give enough credit to Alan for a bunch of things, but he was kind enough to review our first contract for Twilight Struggle. So as a result of the help that I got from this Spiel des Jahres winning designer, I always try and help younger designers because I was lucky enough to get that kind of handout myself. But yes, so he'd never played my game. He didn't really probably even know what it was about. No earthly idea. But I was going to The Gathering shortly after Twilight Struggle had been published. And The Gathering is like a 2-week convention. And I didn't have enough time off to be there for 2 weeks. So I was showing up the second weekend and I walk in and one of my friends runs up to me and is like, Jason, have you seen Alan? And I said, no, I just got here. What do you mean, have I seen Alan? And they said, well, Alan Moon has taken your game, Twilight Struggle, and locked himself away in a room and is only playing Twilight Struggle this whole convention. And it won't do anything else. And because this was a convention full of Eurogamers and weirdly influential Eurogamers, people who are like reviewers or running magazines or had designs of their own with European publishers, it really got a bunch of important, influential people to try Twilight Struggle, and they liked it too. And then all of a sudden, we had some hype, and the rating on Board Game Geek skyrocketed, so much so that the people at Board Game Geek adjust the rating system to try and keep Twilight Struggle down.
Really?
Yeah, it did slow it for a second, and then it just kept on climbing. So honestly, it was a little weird for me because it was odd to have games that I so profoundly admire and have your own game like go over it. I'm like, is this really better than El Grande? I don't know. You know, that's
it is better than El Grande, but El Grande is a great game.
Yeah.
That's a nice story, because if you're having a designer legend like Alan Moon on your side, he has done Ticket to Ride at that time. He was a very famous publisher back then, and he's successful to this day. Regarding the process of developing the game, what kind of game elements were there from the first second and which come over time adding to the game? I'm thinking about 10 rounds, 8 cards, the global setting with early, mid and late war, the space race, the different DEFCON situations and the definition which kind of actions are not possible anymore if the DEFCON decreases. So can you remember what kind of elements came very late or which elements did drop out? Or you were thinking about and you had to say, well, that's not going to fit in the setting without going over 3 hours or 4 hours. So can you give me some insights in the developing process of that year where you had the prototype being adjusted to what we know now as Twilight Struggle?
Ananda and I started with a structure that I have used in game design ever since, which is we established up front what our basic parameters were going to be. Like, we wanted it to last roughly this long. Then we were like, okay, how long does it take to play a card, typically? So knowing that, we were like, okay, well, it can't be more than 200 cards. This is also like, how many cards can you put on a print sheet? So we would have a sense of how many cards could we reasonably include in the deck. We always knew it had to be global in scale, to be clear. So even the first draft map was global in scale. And the early, mid, late war, we stole from Passive Glory, so that was like an early adoption. The tricky part, honestly, was all of the things that we had to remove. Both of us had played a game in the 1980s, you guys may recall it, called Balance of Power.
My brother has played it.
Yeah. Chris Crawford, brilliant designer, actually has written an interesting book on his design process that I read much after Twilight Struggle was produced, but some of the lessons in there I've taken forward. But in any event, the other thing that we decided right up front and is stolen from Chris Crawford was that nuclear war is a bad thing. And we were going to punish players for starting one. And we toyed around with how to do it. We didn't immediately decide that the structure that we currently have, where if it happens on your watch, you are responsible. We got there after many iterations of playtest. But as you will remember from late 80s, early 90s game design, we had a ton of Cold War games, but almost all of them were like hypothetical Soviet Union, NATO, go to war in Germany or whatever the scenario was.
Yeah, you'll have to regard that the USSR was still existing. So you had a retrospective in 2000.
Indeed. But almost all of them would include a nuclear component, but it was a happy-go-lucky, let's launch nuclear weapons. And that's, first of all, maybe not responsible game design. And second of all, not how the Cold War was experienced. The experience of the Cold War was, how do we avoid this outcome? And we wanted players very much focused on that thing. How do you avoid causing a nuclear war?
And it's more realistic, because that's why it's called Cold War, not Hot War.
Yeah, precisely so. The other thing that was just a weird element of design, and it's like a design lesson that I have carried forward, the initial draft of Twilight Struggle had much more of a military component. But we found if you give military tools to wargamers, they will not stop using them. They will disfavor all of the other things that you provide them as tools, and they will continue to monkey around with tanks.
Yeah,
we had to take the toys away from them. That was the, you know, that was the only solution.
And then you developed the military operations element.
Yeah. That's right. So military operations became the way that we ended up solving it. And with military operations, then we found that players became too conservative. So
risk avoiding.
Yeah, exactly. Risk avoidance. So we had to kind of compel them a little bit. And that's how we ended up with this DEFCON military operations system that makes players to be a little more aggressive.
I think these were great game design decisions. First one with whoever steers DEFCON to one loses, which has obviously also the educational component of the Cold War. And on the other hand, the mechanic of lowering DEFCON, which is, I would say, in most games I've played, DEFCON would be at level 2 for most of the game.
Yeah.
Which creates an interesting asymmetry for playing USSR and playing America, because USSR always gets to coup first. So this is an interesting asymmetry throughout the game, which is also supported by this design decision.
I think it's also historical correct, because if you think about the Iron Curtain, Europe won't change from 1950 to 1988, 1989. And so I think that the system you have integrated with the DEFCON levels on Asia and on Europe, that there's not too much progress on the map for one or the other side, except you enter certain stages of the time era that was also feeling very realistic within the scenario.
You are 100% right. And that was very conscious and was kind of an early thing that we adopted, just because there were two problems. If you give players a gigantic map and you don't tell them what to do, it's so confusing to them. They're not having a good experience, right? And so the scoring card system of Twilight Struggle that tells you in early war, Europe, Asia, and the Middle East are important. So pay attention to those, helps guide players what's important and where they should be placing their influence or where they should focus their attention. So that ended up being helpful, but it's an important part of the real historical narrative. That's where the Cold War developed, and Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia kind of enter the war a bit later. Additionally, this is not discussed so much, but it's also the truth. There is a little bit of an anachronistic quality to the Twilight Struggle map, in that a bunch of countries that you're technically allowed to play in the early war are still colonies. They're property of Great Britain and France. They're not actually independent countries yet. And the scoring cards help steer you away from dropping influence in Nigeria in the early war when they're not even a real participant in the Cold War yet.
Yeah, but the Palestine event is early war.
Yeah, that's right. That is early war for sure.
But it's 1956, and I think 1960 or something is the change in Egypt. But it still fits completely well to the topic.
Oh, yeah.
You left out the army system, because the biggest standing army in 1945 was the Russians. So the Soviet Union had a superiority in conventional weapons. And I think those early cards, which have a real chance to take over Italy or France, or even with a blockade the German side, I think that makes it interesting for having a hypothetical dominance in Europe. But you can also fix it with the Marshall Plan, with the Truman Doctrine, with some other events, that it works out historically. And then you have the Iron Curtain there where it is. But if you're talking about the game itself, you said roughly 200 cards, so you ended up with 120, and there are some optional cards as well, which were introduced later on. So was it the reason for leaving out something like the Hungarian Uprising or the Prague Spring, or even later events that happened in Europe, like the junta in Greece or something like that, that you said, yeah, well, those areas were relatively frozen and it doesn't add too much to the game? Or what kind of reasons did you have for leaving those major events out of the Cold War scenario, like Tito and Yugoslavia or something like this?
Indeed. So Tito and Yugoslavia, or Prague Spring, or Hungary, Budapest Uprising, and there are actually quite a few others that get a little less Western attention.
Yeah, I just did it as an example.
Yeah, of course, of course. We aggregated those into cards. So socialist unrest, or independent reds, or socialist governments in the West, those are supposed to represent a number of those events. And why they're recurring is that in some cases we were like, we're not going to hardwire what country the Budapest Uprising happens in. It could be any of these Eastern Bloc countries. And similarly, whether there's a socialist government in Italy, the Netherlands, France, or Belgium doesn't really matter that much. It's just like some of the underpinnings of the Western alliance are eroding because they've elected more leftist governments. And that was a recurring theme in the West.
Especially in the 50s and 60s, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it is also true that sometimes we're extraordinarily specific with events if we say this thing has to happen here.
Poland, Willy Brandt.
Exactly. So we use both approaches to card design, and it wasn't a terribly hard rule, but a lot of people have asked me in the past, why would you leave Prague Spring out? It wasn't that we left Prague Spring out. We've tried to aggregate it into this event so it doesn't have to be Prague Spring. It could be
wherever, Romania or something.
Yeah.
So if you look on the European map, you have a lot of countries looking to America, South America, or to the Asian side, or to Africa. What kind of countries did you leave out? Because when I think you're developing the game, I think Africa, first of all, has like 25 spots, and then you see, oh, that's too much, and you surely have reduced it. So how did that development happen within designing the game?
We had, again, little rules. The rule in this case was if you were an actual battleground of the Cold War, you got in. Like if there was a civil war, it was a proxy war between the United States and the Soviet Union. So Angola and Mozambique and a lot of the Southern African countries that had those kinds of conflicts were automatically included. If you are a resource-rich country that was potentially a source of Cold War conflict or certainly was an important ally like Nigeria and its oil or the Zaire, now Congo with its various resources, then you're in. And then everybody else, it became a little bit more of a question of linkages and geography. Which countries did we need on the map to make sure that they had proper linkage to get a chain of influence down to other places or battlegrounds?
So that it's good playable.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I like these decisions. The idea that giving a little bit of historical accuracy for playability, I also really like that.
It adds also depth. If you are starting the Warsaw Pact early as a US player, you know that there might be some advantages coming up for you in the future. So if it's always in the deck in late war, what are you doing then?
It makes the game less plannable, which is also good for replayability, because if you have a dedicated card for every second country, then you could say there will be one card coming for Western Germany, there will be one card coming for Italy, one for France, and this is not the case. There are a few, like for France, Egypt, and Western Germany and Eastern Germany, but these are main countries, and nobody needs a card for the Southeast African states or something, so this is also well chosen.
Yeah, but I was always wondering about the Southeast region area, that there's just one Vietnam card. So looking back, like 1963 to 1975, that was a major event on the US side. So you have a Southeast scoring at that time with the mid-war, which is just happening once. So I think there's the focus on it, and you have the China card where you can invest a lot in Asia in that time. But I was always like, yeah, that's the only thing, because Cambodia is influenced, Thailand is influenced, Vietnam is influenced in those days, Burma. So it shook up the whole region for nearly two decades. So that was always with the traumata the people had in the US with the Vietnam War. Just having one card was like, 2 points. That's not a major event with action points. It's not a major event on the card because of the low stability in those countries, which is correct because they were very unstable. But I was always feeling like that left out something.
A little. Vietnam is really a very difficult thing to simulate in a strategic game of any scale, because on the one hand, as you say, it is a humongous distortion in U.S. relations with a number of those countries. It destabilizes all of its neighbors. It distorts our relationship with the Chinese. It's a problem with the Japanese. It's a problem in India. It's a gigantic thing. And then we spend billions and billions of dollars on it. We sacrifice all of these lives of our troops and damage the quality of our army. All of those things are 1,000% true. And then we leave and it no longer matters.
The problem is also the stagnation of the economics, the downgrading of the dollar, the high debts in credits for the state. So that was also an outcome of the political or the economical side of the Vietnam War. So I think that troubled the US also after ending the war for many years. And the high inflation of the late 70s and early 80s was also caused by some aftershocks, which were linked to this heavy conflict in Southeast Asia.
But the one thing I would say is Twilight Struggle doesn't just reflect the Vietnam conflict with Vietnam revolts and the scoring card. The most important reflection of the Vietnam War in Twilight Struggle is Quagmire. And that is the card that is supposed to reflect the fact that the United States could lose the Cold War based on this stupid thing that it has done in Vietnam. And of course, it has a parallel card with Bear Trap so that the Soviets do the same thing in Afghanistan. And that's how we're trying to model these things that you're talking about.
If you roll enough fives or sixes, you are lost.
What was your personal record for rolling fives and sixes consecutively? I think I've rolled like 10 or something.
Yeah, it's the thing. I mean, if you haven't lost Twilight Struggle by Quagmire or Bear Trap, you haven't played it often enough.
It can happen, yes, that's true. So after having so much insights in the process, how often do you estimate did you play Twilight Struggle in your life now?
Honestly, it would be so hard for me to estimate because I played so much online. Probably at this stage, I may have played more online than I have face-to-face. But, you know, whatever number I give you, even if it's 10,000, I know Twilight Struggle hack players who played many more times than I are. And they're way better at it than I am. So that's just the reality of it.
Yeah, but that shows that many people are into your game completely.
But you still play it today?
Yeah, sure. I still play today. It has a great reputation, but it's also kind of an old game. So the reason I end up playing now is like people who are new to the hobby, who heard of Twilight Struggle, but they've never played it. And so they want to learn how.
We recommended it to our friends. So if you're interested in playing against the stronger opponent, you'll have to ask my brother.
I don't think I would stand a chance against Jace.
There's Quagmire and the Bear Trap. So you never know.
When you're playing online, you're using the Playdeck version?
Yeah, I use Playdeck. There are several other online ways that you can play it, but I mostly use Playdeck because I think it's a very smooth implementation of the game. And even if there are a few little bugs, even still, it's better than any alternative.
And you have the speeches always before your turn starts. That's great.
Yeah. One thing I don't like is that the game does not warn you that you will lose the game and push the red button. This is the only thing I don't like. But apart from that, it's a great implementation of the game.
So people can be challenged by you on the Playdeck version. That's interesting to know. So the game itself was developed by Playdeck for computers. Did they contact you regularly? Did they ask you for feedback? Or did they just have the license and say, yeah, that's the product and please buy it in our store? Or what was the relationship between Playdeck or the contact you had with the game developers?
They were super nice guys. They were very solicitous and nice to both Ananda and me. It was interesting to see what they thought was unclear. So there was a lot of feedback, honestly, because they have to implement each of these cards precisely and implement it from a computer logic point of view. So it wasn't like a full-time job on my end to reply to their questions, but we were talking probably almost daily or a couple of times a week about questions they had about card implementation when they were in the middle of it. So it was mostly those kind of rule questions that they had, and that was the source of our participation.
Clarifying some things.
Yeah. Of course, they showed it to us in advance and they let us play a beta version or an alpha version even maybe. And since had the chance to meet all those guys in person, they're really nice people. And so I enjoyed that process.
So this game is available on Steam. You can purchase it anytime. It's heavily reduced normally in Steam sales. So I recommend this to every listener in our audience who hasn't played Twilight Struggle, because if you're used to the online version, you can play it in under 60 minutes if you're really quick. And if you are going for turn 10, you might need 90, but that's a fair and very quick way to play a game with that depth at all.
And a good way to learn. Also, if you have never played, you can pick up at least the basics of the game before you deal with a human opponent.
Yeah, they have a tutorial in it and the AI is solid to weak, but for a new player, it's solid. And I think the USSR plays a bit better when you're facing the AI, but it's not like they are doing random moves. That's not happening within the game.
The process when you are, like, for example, talking to the Playdeck guys, or also when you were answering questions on BoardGameGeek, which you did quite frequently. I'm wondering, did you also discover some of the errata or something years after the game has been released? And did you have to some sort of take decisions of how a card should be played? Or was everything clear when the game was released and you just had to clarify?
I cannot tell you how bizarre that is. It wasn't that long ago. I'm going to say it's like a year and a half ago that I got a question in from Jason Carr on a card interaction. I can't recall quite what it was at this stage, but no one had ever seen it before. We'd never had the question before. We went through everything we'd ever did, and it was still a brand new problem. Maybe at this stage, it's sort of annoying. It says something cool about how many card interactions are humanly possible in the game. But nowadays, mostly in the forums on BoardGameGeek, someone will ask a question and one of the other shark players will answer for them. And I don't even have to get around to it. But there was, as you know, in the early years, we were doing that all day, every day.
Yeah. And it's also easy to understand, like the famous example of Accident Allies carrier movement in combat and non-combat. I think the guys have written books over it and nobody can agree on how it should be handled in some of the more complex cases. And this should be quite the same.
And situations which are happening one in a million.
Yeah, exactly.
And then people in the Board Game Geek, they are citing your comments on these and then they agree on how to play it. And even it's not an extremely complex game, but these complex situations do occur. Like Exit Ally is actually a very easy game and also a complex situation.
But it has very good written rules. That's always on Larry Harris games. And most of the GMT games we regularly play, and that's Twilight Struggle as well, has a well-written rule. There are some which are weird and then you can't get access to the game itself. So I think that factor shouldn't be underestimated.
Yes, it has well-written rules and the translation in German is very good.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Udo Grebe Games, that's the publisher in Germany.
Yeah, and this is not true for every game, because we have played card-driven games which have bad translation in German, and this makes them hard to understand, and at every second card you have to open Board Game Geek and ask something about it. And this is not the case for Twilight Struggle. The translation there is very good.
Yeah.
I had a really interesting conversation with Bruno Vaiduti, the famous European designer from France, and we were having dinner with some Spanish publishers, and there was another German game designer there. Both the French and the German game designer said that they wrote their rules in English first, as that English is better for legalese than either French or German, and so writing rules in French, you know, is impossible, because repeating the same word sounds odd in French, but when you're writing law in English, that's what you have to do, because if you use a different word, it means something slightly different. So they would write first in English and then translate back into French.
But how many languages the Twilight Struggle has been translated into?
Oh, a ton. Japanese, Chinese, Hungarian, Polish, Czech, Italian, French, Spanish. German, Spanish, Portuguese, Canadian, whatever they speak there.
Yeah, 51st state, they'll have to speak English soon.
Quite.
I'm wondering also about the game title, because the game title has been changed for Germany. It's called Gleichgewicht des Schreckens in Germany, which is a little of an odd title for people which are not used to it. And its original title is a citation, and the German also. Do you think that's the case for all of the languages? And has it been a styling pattern for the title, or do other languages just use the original title?
It's a mix of both, just depending on, for instance, I think in the Spanish editions, it's Guerra Fría, Cold War, and I think a lot of localizers have gone with that. But then if you are a publisher in a country where you're servicing a niche number of players who are very aware of Euro games, then using the original title is less complicated, because they know they're looking for, quote, Twilight Struggle, so it's easier to do it that way.
And it became a brand.
It became a brand of its own, right? So it's easier to just call it by its original English name, so the players know that they're getting the thing that they're looking for.
Who's owning the rights of the brand Twilight Struggle?
Well, I mean, graciously, the way GMT contracts work, everything is on lease to GMT. And if at any point in time they should decide not to publish it for, I think, more than a year, then the rights revert to Ananda.
Bad luck.
I mean, at this stage, they're probably going to keep publishing it as long as they possibly can, sir.
Yes.
So I'll see them anytime.
You had a lot of critical acclaim, and we are praising the game over and over again in this podcast. But what kind of main critiques did you face, by singular persons or by certain decisions, like giving Iran just one influence at the start? So there are certain points people approach to you, talking to you on a convention or going in depth about the game. So do you remember certain things that fans or players came up with?
I think the critique that I most agreed with when I encountered it, it was shortly after the game came out, and it was somebody who was very disappointed with the game. And the reason he was so disappointed with the game is he was looking for a game that went deeply into the processes that the United States and the Soviet Union made to make decisions. He wanted the way the United States behave internally to be reflected in Twilight Struggle, as opposed to the way the Soviet Union behaved internally to be reflected in Twilight Struggle. And Ananda and I made a very express decision that we were going to treat the two superpowers in the game exactly the same. They can do precisely the same things. They're not asymmetric. And one of the things that we're suggesting or poking at is there are no real heroes to the Cold War. There's a narrative out there that the United States won and yay freedom, but a lot of not so wonderful things happened, and both superpowers are equally responsible for a lot of those not so wonderful things. And so that's why we ignore all of that. Twilight Struggle is value neutral and there's no villain to it.
It is what it is, and you do not judge the political systems. That's true, because they're always kind of a background story that you're fighting for communism or democracy or for capitalism maybe, but they are not valued as good or bad.
Right.
And both sides have not been perfect with over those 50 years.
Not even close.
Yeah, it's the opposite, like, for example, in Labyrinth, where you're playing the War Against Terror, where both playable factions play completely differently and don't have similar actions.
And they have a deck that is too big.
Yeah, that's true. It was funny listening to Volko talk about that, because initially he thought that people wouldn't want to play the terrorists when he designed Labyrinth. Then he sent it out to Wargamer playtesters and they only wanted to play the terrorists.
Yeah, but that's not a surprise, because if you're playing Axis and Allies, what kind of nation is picked first?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the Americans play a little annoying in Labyrinth.
Yeah, precisely.
They are hard to play. I think the game has not a perfect balance. That's the problem. And it takes too long if you're playing a full campaign. And it has too much random appearance of the cards. And you'll have to know a lot of cards. And they are not structured as it is in Path of Glory or in Twilight Struggle. And that would help the game if there's another edition coming out. But yeah, I know that it's a very popular game and we own it and we enjoyed playing it. But if there's a gold standard, it's below that, I'll have to admit.
But that's what Jason said with steering the players. When you play Labyrinth, you see how good it helps when you have these early, mid, and late war cards. Because when you're starting playing Labyrinth, you have no idea what to do.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I also have probably played Labyrinth much more with the playdeck implementation than I have in person. And to your point, you benefit so much from deck knowledge in Labyrinth to play it successfully. I couldn't play it successfully until I played a bunch of times online so that I understood the way the deck was constructed.
Same for us. So asking you about Twilight Struggle, there was a Turn Zero expansion coming up, and it gives a bit of variety of the starting positions, and there's some new ways to approach the game depending on the outcome of those starting events. But in my experience, you can roll the die so badly that it is close to not worth starting it. So the big variety comes up with a certain level of unplayability on certain outcomes. So what is your position on that expansion? Do you normally play it or don't?
I certainly have played it. Of course, we play tested it a bit. The notion was mostly to just give a structure for variability for the setup. And you are absolutely right that if one player rolls badly through all of the turn zero cards or scenarios, they're going to start at a huge disadvantage and probably not be able to win. And so maybe we should have come up with something that has less random variability. But if you look at most of the events, they have relatively small impacts. They have smaller impacts than most of the events of a Twilight Struggle card. We're just trying to mix it up a little bit. That's what we were doing with that. We stole that idea of Turn Zero from the Zero comic book trend, like a bunch of comic books were coming out with first edition that they were calling issue zero. Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you for that statement, because that's always overlooked a bit. And I think it's a nice variation. But depending on good luck, bad luck, it doesn't make the game equal between two strong players anymore. If you're new to the game, I think that might help to enjoy the game even more. But if you're really deep into Twilight Struggle, I think those small changes, you might run in danger to lose the balance.
Indeed. You know, and if somebody were to suggest some alternative for the way to resolve those cards, both Ananda and I would be totally open to an alternative. But most of the deep Twilight Struggle players are purists. They like the first set of expansion cards that they almost all play with all of them. But other than that, they don't want any changes to the game at all.
Yeah, we always play with the optional cards, but we leave out the turn zero expansion as well.
Talking about little balances to the game in the competitive playing environment, it seems like people have agreed that there should be a little tweak for US in the beginning starting position. I think they have a bidding system. I'm not fully aware, but in most cases, I think the community agrees, like one extra influence for US, which is mostly played in Iran. That comes out after a million of games played, where it shows like the Soviets have won 50.8% of them, I think. Would you say that's okay?
Yeah, of course, I think it's okay. And I try and do everything I can to encourage the International Twilight Struggle League. Those are great guys. I love that this exists as kind of a sub hobby for certain people. I love that it's international and people all over the world are enjoying the game that way. And so whatever they need to do to get their tournaments close to zero balance is perfectly fine by me. We have talked about, since we have this anniversary edition coming up relatively soon, whether we would go ahead and make this adjustment that is true in most competitive play by giving the US an additional influence. I wouldn't personally probably ever specify that it has to be Iran, just because Iran is ahistorical to have a bunch of US influence.
Right.
As most of you guys know, the Soviets were actually occupying a big chunk of Iran at the time.
1946, 1947, yes.
Yeah. So it doesn't make total sense from a historical point of view. But if the U.S. had one more influence that they could play anywhere in the world and they typically placed it in Iran, that's certainly a concession for play balance that I would make.
Yeah. From my personal opinion, I think it's not necessary, but I haven't played a million of games and I haven't really played competitively, because on turn one, I mean, we know that the Russians often had a sort of a head start into the game, and with a good coup roll in round one in Iran, that's even more the case, but it doesn't mean they're winning the game. There are so many factors which have to be considered, and scoring cards and everything. So in my opinion, it's not necessary to place that extra influence. And when you play a few games, it is some sort of an advantage for the US, because the first coup has a higher opportunity to fail.
Exactly. I personally agree, but you know, whatever. It's not a crisis one way or the other.
Right. I think the game is good as it is, but as you said, it's like 50 point something for the USSR, and it depends a bit on the early war off. So did you experiment with other dices than those six rolls, 10, two dices, or was it always clear that you were doing the conflicts in a one die for every side to roll?
And don't tell us you stole it from Paths of Glory.
Yeah, we did think about it.
Mm-hmm.
We did experiment a little bit. I think we talked about a D10. Maybe we played with a D8 early on just to see. But the bigger the dice, the larger the potential swing.
Yeah.
And so we ended up going the other way.
I think it was a good decision, but I was just asking for curiosity. So it has sold a lot of copies. Do you know actually how many were sold until February 2025, or let's say 2024, December?
I do not know the actual number, and I don't know that I will ever be able to figure out, because the reporting back from the international editions. But what I know for sure is it's been GMT's strongest selling game since it came out, and that will be 20 years ago today. Even today, it leads their sales, and as a result, it is the best-selling war game, or classically speaking, a war game, to have been published.
Do you have a figure which you are very sure about that they have reached like 50,000, 100,000 sold copies? I have researched a bit, so I have an idea where it is roughly, but can you precise it a bit?
It's over 100,000 copies just from GMT. And then all the foreign editions, that's where I don't really know. I know, for instance, that the Spanish are on their 10th edition of Twilight Struggle. So, you know, that's another
12,000 or something. Yeah.
20 times P500. So if you go to GMT, you are not a nobody. So is it easier with that success in your personal history to say, hey, I have a game idea like Solar Fide? Because normally someone would say, ah, that might be medieval, could be a very specific topic, not sure to place it on P500. So how did the relationship with the publisher change?
I am glad you brought up Solar Fide.
But Jaden Matthews is calling and we should have a look.
That is a completely a German story, Solo Fide. We had published a game about the election between Barack Obama and John McCain, campaign manager. And I had done that with my friend Christian Leonard, who's also the co-designer on 1960. And so obviously we've been doing political games. And we were approached by the owner of Spielwerks, which is a small German niche publisher, because he loved playing campaign manager with his wife. And the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther nailing his theses on the door.
2017?
Yeah, exactly. Was approaching, and he was trying to have a game design that he could sell in museums in Germany in time for the anniversary. So he approached me initially and said, well, could you do Campaign Manager as a game between Catholics and Protestants? And I was like, well, okay, I'm certainly interested in the Reformation. Let me start doing a little reading and see what we can come up with. And I went off and read several books on the Reformation. Super fascinating subject. I'm so glad I read about it. I think it's hard to understand European history until you understand what was going on during the Reformation. But I came back and I'm like, oh, well, I'm thinking two-player game, something maybe about the weight of 1960, take an hour and a half, et cetera, et cetera. And the owner of Spielwerks was like, yeah, that sounds fantastic, except for I'm going to need your game design in 2 months. Oh, okay. Well,
challenging.
Let's go back to retheming Campaign Manager. So Solo Fide is as much history as I could include in a redeveloped Campaign Manager to try and represent the events of the Reformation. And it wasn't my idea to design this game. It was just something that was requested by a friend of mine. And of course, it's an interesting topic, so I was happy to do it. But it wasn't a game we pitched to GMT or anyone else.
But that's a really nice story.
Yeah.
Do you have any weird or insane story we can't ask for because it happened to you just in private life or in public life at a convention regarding Twilight Struggle you can share with us and our audience?
Weird stories involving Twilight Struggle. I was attacked by a girl who was a giant Twilight Struggle fan and had Twilight Struggle fingernail painted. She was trying to kiss me, so that was a little weird. But this is a cool thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah, being kissed by a girl is not the worst thing.
It was not terrifying either, but it was just a game. Simmer down.
Yeah.
In some kind of vain thing, the cover of my cell phone.
It's the Red Sea cover.
And so everybody getting on a plane, I'm in my phone walking down the line and the guy is already sitting there and he sees my phone case and he's like, hey, that's a great game. And I'm like, hey, I'm the designer of that.
And did he believe you?
Yeah, he believed. I actually had a copy of it in my briefcase because I was just flying home from a convention.
So asking you about fame, in your normal life, I guess that's not the case that anyone's kissing you on the streets or you're being hunted by Hollywood reporters. But being on a convention, I think you're pretty well known or famous for wargamers, are you?
That seems to be the case. I'm always surprised when someone recognizes me kind of anywhere, but it does happen. And I'm lucky enough to be invited to conventions and whatnot. I guess it was 2 years ago, I was invited to Mexico City. They have a large convention now in Mexico, which is exciting on a bunch of levels, just to see that the hobby's growing in Mexico and they have all of these budding gamers and designers. But I was going down and I'm like, no one is going to know Twilight Struggle in Mexico. What is this? Kind of silly. I'm going to be sitting there alone. And I could not have been more wrong. All sorts of people had played Twilight Struggle in Mexico and were eager to talk about the game. So that was super gratifying and a wonderful experience, honestly.
Stability of two on a battlefield land. What did you expect?
Yeah. Did they ask you why they're a battleground country?
Has the success of the game changed your private life? Or what did your friends say? What did your family say about becoming a game designer? Couldn't you do a better job? Or is it like, yeah, you did it right and we were all wrong? So how are those talks end up nowadays?
I think if you attain any minor fame in life and you want to make sure that you don't develop a large ego, you should have children because they will definitely poke your ego for you. My children refer to me as a micro celebrity, and they're not impressed in any way, shape, or form with any of these things. The only thing, for the first time, they were like mildly proud of the fact their father was famous was when Twilight Struggle showed up on South Park, and that they paid attention to. They were like, oh my God, Dad's game's on South Park.
That's funny. I do not know that episode, but I will look it up. Yeah, it's always hard to impress the children. They are impressed by things you see as normal, and the things you have achieved, they are like, yeah, that's how I know him. That's normal.
Exactly. There has been a point in your life, obviously, where you have been doing other things for a living, like developing board games. And have you reached a level now where you're getting offers for giving advice for other game developers or even for companies, which might not even be only for gaming?
In real life, I am a lobbyist and I had spent 13 years working in the U.S. Senate and I'm a lawyer. So I still do all of those things, mostly because even though I get real money from game design, but not so much that I could put children through college in the United States.
I understand, yeah.
So I still maintain my occupation and profession. But I have had, and I think this will continue, I've been approached and have participated in a lot of events affiliated with the Department of Defense. And the budding war game development that is occurring there to assist with some of their projects or consult on their projects. And a lot of other war game designers have done that kind of work here in Washington in the past. Of course, Volko comes from a game design background within the CIA, and Mark Herman used to be a Beltway Bandit consultant that did work with the DoD. So all of that is normal. Recently, I did a project with a Polish company. They're reprinting Masters of Orion as a board game.
Mm-hmm.
I played it ever since I was young. So I guess that is a little more of a thing for me now than it was before. Maybe that's just something that always happens to old people. Eventually, you stop doing anything of use and you consult.
That's how it works.
You haven't reached the level of being old. There are much older designers. So as long as you keep going, that's fine. Talking about Twilight Struggle, there's the 20th anniversary coming up with a new edition. So what can fans expect out of that edition? Is it just new pictures? Is it rules errata like you were talking about Iran, yes or no, or the one influence set by the US? Or is it also that there's some new cards appearing or some smaller updates are coming up with the game?
It will literally be all of those things. The entire art product will be revised, and I think people will be wowed by how much effort GMT has put into that and how fantastic the art outcome really is. So new cover, new map, new cards, all of them redone. And of course, we're scouring to try and make sure we have captured all the errata in the rulebook. This is a funny other story. When we were going through Twilight Struggle Red Sea, we uncovered what we thought was an annoying oversight. Like Red Sea doesn't have a China card. It has, instead of a China card, a Romania card. Mm-hmm. And the card in that game, just like in Twilight Struggle, if you hold it at the end of the game, it's worth a victory point, right? So you don't use it. And that rule is written on the card itself, but someone had asked, hey, it's not in the rule book. And there's nothing at the end of the Twilight Struggle Red Sea rules that say that you should give a victory point if you hold on to the Romania card. And we were like, how is that possible? We took the Twilight Struggle rule book and started there and edited and edited and edited. But we started with the Twilight Struggle rule book. Did we just like chop off a section? And we went back to the Twilight Struggle rule book. Guess what other rule book doesn't have a rule that says if you hold the China card at the end of the game, you get a victory point. And no one has brought that up in 20 years.
You have found the one in a million people.
Yeah, exactly.
So that'll be fixed in the new rulebook. But yeah, we're trying to get all the errata. The other thing I think that is exciting and interesting to new players, it'll have a double-sided map board, and we're going to have an alternative history start. And the presumption in the alternative history is that the war plan at the end of the war that was canceled at the last minute, that the Soviet Union would invade Hokkaido, actually occurs. And so instead of divided Korea, you get divided Japan, rather. And that has all of these ramifications about the United States trying to defend imperialism in Asia longer than it would have, because suddenly the Cold War is in Japan. And
so there are frictions of alternative history included on the alternative map. That sounds interesting.
Exactly.
And there will be a set of new events reflective of some of our speculating would be outcomes as a result of that new beginning.
For the enhanced version or the alternative version, and the classic one won't be untouched, or how about that?
The classic version will be untouched, except for we made sure we could acquire the rights of all of the localization cards that have been done by foreign publishers, and those will all be included in the base game as well as options. You don't have to fold them in, but if you want to try some of those cards, they're available.
That sounds very promising, and I saw that it was on BoardGameGeek, and we are thinking about a pre-order because we know about the quality, and that might replace then this German version. So what kind of challenges did you go through developing Red Sea?
Well, Red Sea had a variety of changes. I'm kind of proud of the way the game turned out, because the initial motivator was having lived through that portion of the Cold War. I remember very distinctly watching news about what had happened in Ethiopia. The famines in particular got a ton of news, but I remember news discussions about the civil war in Ethiopia and why all of the famines were happening, what the source of all the catastrophe had been. And we had never included it as a card in Twilight Struggle. And so a little bit of a COVID project, I guess. I was like, well, we didn't get the card in. Let me just do a small game about it. And in addition, GMT had started this lunchtime series game where they wanted games that you could play in 45 minutes at lunch. So I was like, it's a small conflict. It's a relatively unknown conflict to everybody, unless you're a real student of African history or a student in depth of the Cold War. It's not the sort of thing that I would want a game that lasted 3 hours. And then in addition, I have an awareness that a lot of people have bought Twilight Struggle on its reputation, but it sits unplayed on their shelf because they haven't figured out a way to on-ramp it. And 3 hours sounds like too much of a time commitment for them, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted there to be a way to learn Twilight Struggle that was a little more accessible, at least in terms of time commitment. With that notion in mind, it puts a ton of tight parameters on this game, namely that the map can't be very big, the number of cards can't be too crazy.
Number of countries.
Yeah, exactly. But I wanted players to get most of the feel of the game. Like, after you played Red Sea, I wanted you to feel like you've had kind of a Twilight Struggle experience and not some other thing, so that you can decide after you've tried Red Sea, oh, I really like that, I want more, let me play the full game, or maybe I hated that, I never want to try Twilight Struggle. Whatever the thing is, at least you've got a sense of it.
I think you succeeded with that, because it feels atmospheric and it also feels like Twilight Struggle playing it. The only criticism I had was like, I can understand the lunchtime approach, but I was always like, yeah, two turns, maybe three in the optional rules. That's not enough for me playing the game. I think that it would be better having three phases, because the number of cards is pretty low. So some cards do not appear even. Four cards are left that won't come up to the battle deck. So I was always missing that progress you had on early, mid and late war. And there you had one phase, which was mid war. And I was like, it's interesting to play. Some events are very powerful. I like the famine factor. I like that most likely will the DEFCON change gamble, yes or no. And I like the victory conditions, and it feels like a Cold War game which was ripped out of Twilight Struggle for a certain scenario. So you did very well, but it was also, because it's so short, it felt a bit shallow. And that was the criticism I had as an experienced player. But for entering the Twilight Struggle franchise, I think it's very approachable as well. So you have reached your targets when that was the intention you had.
Yeah, that's right. I definitely was not designing it for very experienced Twilight Struggle players, other than, you know, if they want to try something different. I do also care a little bit about the history of it, because it is one of these things that most Americans are blithely unaware of, and they read every day what is happening in the Horn of Africa, both in Yemen and Somalia, and they look at those countries, and we have, again, a president who referred to those places as shithole countries, and it's important for Americans to know the reason that those countries are in the state they're in are because of foreign policy decisions that this country made in the 70s. And when we flooded Ethiopia, Somalia, and the two Yemens with weapons and destabilized those countries for 25 years, we're living now with the impact of foreign policy decisions we made back in the Cold War.
Yeah, don't forget about Sudan. And I think most Americans say 70s, there was the rumble in the jungle. And was there anything else in Africa? All you need to know as an American is that Barack Obama became an African after Trump declared that he's not from Hawaii.
Exactly.
You don't need to know more. Do not do any reading. You'll only be depressed. I did want to express some aspect of this history and try and expose people a little bit to what had happened in the past. I totally understand the criticism that I am enjoying this game. It could be longer, and I would like it more if I got a little bit of that same wave effect that you get in Twilight Struggle, where the early war is distinct from the mid war, which is distinct from the late war, and each one of those phases of the game feels differently. That was left on the cutting room floor. There was really no way to do that in the amount of time.
Yeah, I had to do a compromise. So if your focus was to have an easy game, accessible in under an hour, you reached your goal. And I think the balance is there within the game, and it's still challenging and deep enough to be worth playing. But for very experienced players, I think it has a little bit too less meat to come up to the table very often.
When you were developing Red Sea, did you have the idea in mind to combine it with the main game initially?
Yeah, I mean, since it started in part to fix the reality that we'd left the history of the Horn of Africa out of Twilight Struggle, I always wanted to make at least somewhat backwards compatible so that you could take some cards from Red Sea. And then if you wanted a slightly longer experience, you could go the other way. Or honestly, as you suggested, you can just play with the full deck and do three turns that way as well. It totally works. I know it works. And the reason it's not included as a variant in the game is I did not get a chance to play test it for balance. So I don't know if it's balanced, but I do know in game terms it works perfectly fine.
You said the 20th anniversary edition is coming up. So could you imagine that you're doing, after Asian Monsoon, maybe a Central and South American expansion, and then 2040, after being really an old game designer, just doing the consultant job? There might be a Twilight Struggle edition coming up, who knows, which has all cards in it.
Yes, the big box edition, for sure. I mean, yeah. DMT is a company. If they can make money, eventually they will.
So you will never get back the rights of Twilight Struggle, I guess.
Probably not happening. The South and Central America is very much of interest, and I did some initial research on it and had put together a very comprehensive list of events. But I think Ananda is interested in doing a spinoff on it. So I actually handed him my historical research for him to work on. So I don't know when he'll get around to it, but I know that he's fiddling around with a design on that subject.
I'm excited to see how he rates the wrecking card for Middle America.
So Asian Monsoon is coming up. Do you want to give us a short sneak preview on what we have to expect there?
Maybe about the current development as well.
Asian Monsoon, a little bit like Red Sea, is a design that I wanted to get at because there's an underlying problem in Twilight Struggle, which is the China card. The China card is cute. I'm very happy with how it works in the game, and a very simple solution to something, but it distorts entirely the history of that relationship between Pakistan, India, and China. So this game is focused on trying to properly simulate India, Pakistan, and China, as well as the regions around them and how they function in the Cold War. And it's a very interesting and kind of a difficult challenge, because you want China to have an important impact in the game, but you don't want it to overwhelm the game so that it's really just about how the Soviet Union and the United States' relationship with China. And the other thing that is an interesting difficulty about this is,
for both the United States and the Soviet Union, this region of the world is the hardest for them for a long time to project power into. The United States 7th Fleet is busy for a huge bulk of this time with Vietnam. So essentially, the United States is not using naval power to project into the Indo-Pacific at the time. We're not even in the Middle East with the Navy at the time until basically the Vietnam War ends. And on the Soviet front, it's so far away from their landmass and so far away from their bases, they end up with submarines and stuff in the Indo-Pacific before the United States does. But they have to send so many tending ships and fuel vessels that it's like 6-1. There's one warship and there are 6 ships to keep the one warship supplied with material. So all of which is to say, Soviet tanks can't reach India. The U.S. Navy's not really in India. So everybody's approach to the region has to be a little more soft power than it is in other regions of the world. It's also why every country in South Asia is part of the non-aligned movement, and they can all get away with it because the superpowers are not able to project power in the same way. So that also ends up meaning that South Asian monsoon will have to be a game that feels different than Twilight Struggle, where your application of power can always be very direct. You're going to have to bank shot it, and there are going to be other considerations as you're placing influence down in these countries.
So you will go a step away from just placing influence to adjacent countries?
You're really going to have to consider the impact of the non-aligned movement and what's that going to mean. You're also going to have to watch what it means with your relationship with the Chinese.
Okay.
There's a lie that underlies Twilight Struggle, which is the only thing that matters is your relationship with the other superpower. All these other countries are just pawns. In this game, that will be a little less true.
Talking about Red Sea, it was late 60s to early 80s. So which kind of phase of the Cold War will be shown in Asian Monsoon?
Time frame in this game will basically be from the Tibetan conquest.
1951.
Yeah, to 1978 when relations with the PRC are fully normalized.
So there's no special economical zones coming up. So it ends with the death of Mao in 1976-77.
Exactly.
I see. Okay, so it's early to mid-war.
Yeah. Essentially, once China becomes a nominal U.S. ally, it's no longer part of the game. And it will be a shorter game than Twilight Struggle, but it'll be a much longer game than Red Sea. So it's trying to be in that middle space. So if Red Sea is introductory Twilight Struggle, this is Twilight Struggle for expert players.
I see. So you're not coming up with a Tiananmen event that couldn't even be answered by DeepSeek. That won't happen.
Yeah, no, we're not doing that yet.
So what kind of unique features or what kind of challenges do you have when you're doing Asian Monsoon at the moment? So what kind of things are still developing and what kind of unique features does the game already have? You have announced something like non-alignment movement. You have announced that medium powers might have a bigger role in it. And I saw in the concept drawings Gandhi and Mao pretty well portrayed as the historical figures of that time, but maybe you can give us some exclusive information as well.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing that is important in this region and is really a defining factor for what the history of the region is decolonization matters so much here. Obviously, with India is to a certain extent the poster child of decolonization, India and Pakistan. And we're dealing directly with the fact a large chunk of these countries are still colonies when the game begins. And there's an evolution of countries coming onto the board and available as the decolonization process with the British and French continues.
French Indochina, the whole Borneo and Singapore area and everything, yeah, Malaysia.
Yeah, exactly. So to a certain extent, we're also acknowledging that Britain and France and their impact in this region matters. Unlike in Twilight Struggle, there's a
Suez Crisis and that's it.
Exactly. And they're whatever. Here, we pretend that a little less. And this is the central dilemma for the United States that its allies are imperial power, but it is trying to curry favor with newly
independent countries,
free nations.
Right. At the same time, you have this non-aligned movement, which for the most part, I think the United States finds threatening to its interests, but having to balance its relationship with India in particular in light of all of that. So it will be kind of a new set of challenges. I think players are really going to like it, but you will kind of have to unlearn a little bit your approach and strategy to Twilight Struggle to play this well.
It plays a bit different.
Yeah, a little, for sure.
So you said Red Sea under 1 hour, Twilight Struggle 3 to 4 hours on an analog board. So what kind of time frame will you give the Asian Monsoon game?
Should be done in 2, I think.
So 5 turns.
Yep.
Can it be combined with Twilight Struggle?
Yes, we'll do the same sort of thing with Red Sea as Twilight Struggle. We'll give you a list of events that load in. We might even be able to throw some events from South Asia Monsoon into Red Sea because the areas are kind of adjacent, or they abut.
As optional cards.
Yeah.
Okay. We already talked about maybe after Asian Monsoon, there could be some Twilight Struggle-related game in America. Other scenario, have you thought about something like an advanced Twilight Struggle where you would scale up all the mechanics you have once scaled down to scale down the game length?
Giving it an additional layer?
Yeah, for feeding the people that want more detailed war games and maybe also create a relation to Twilight Struggle? Or would you say, just you said in the beginning, that it would go into the wrong direction?
There's one other thing that I want to correct about Twilight Struggle, not correct exactly, but more expressly simulate in Twilight Struggle because it's such an important element of the experience of the Cold War, but it's not really to be found in the game, which is the arms race. So if there was ever a layer that would add complexity, it would be maybe some sort of pseudo-economic mechanic about keeping pace in different kinds of weapon systems and how ultimately this ends up ruinous for the Soviet Union and its economy. I mean, it brings both countries to the brink of ruin in a certain regard, but you can identify the end of the Cold War from a variety of causes, and certainly Chernobyl and the failure in Afghanistan and all of these things compounded. But I think there's a real narrative truth in the fact that the Soviets were just beginning to run out of money and
Star Wars and what
Reagan did, but that's nowhere to be found in the base game.
That's true. I was thinking about that next level or layer which could be added, but I think the point is that the USSR always had the masses in weapons and the technology side was broken with the dominance of the Western side in the early 80s. With the technology evolving in the computer systems and with new weaponry like stealth, the conventional side hit another level on the Western allies than it was on the Soviet bloc. And I think that might be interesting to have the game a bit more asymmetric, having masses of people, which are an advantage in the early game, and having a more highly evolved nation coming over time and with economic power. But I think that's very difficult to implement without losing the simplicity, which is very sexy for Twilight Struggle, and having an over-complex game. That's always the risk you run into, and you'll have to figure out how that layer might be worth implementing.
It is a problem because we're already asking players to do a lot in Twilight Struggle in the amount of time that they have. So if you want to keep the game the same length, you're going to have to figure out, what are you giving up? You can add a layer of complexity to the decision making, but I don't really want to add a lot of additional time to the game.
If you're having a weak brand or you are no one on P500, you are completely right. But you have a pretty big fan base and that fan base plays more complex war games. And I can compare it a bit to the Larry Harris thing. If you're playing Axis and Allies Classic and then you're playing Revised and then you're playing Europe and Pacific, the 1940 games combined, there are so many new rules that you would say, if I have introduced the 1940 version, which is very polished and very nice to play, but if he has released that in the early 80s, it might not have been the same success because it's too deep for players in that decade. And I think you have people who have played hundreds of games of Twilight Struggle, so if you are not changing too much of the thing they know and you can add something like an additional ingredients, people wouldn't care too much about an hour extra or about learning a new subsystem or something like this. So I think that can be successful as long as you keep it on a realistic scale of adding rules.
I agree with you. I mean, there's probably a sweet spot there for sure. And it's not like adding an additional minute is a problem. It's not necessarily perfect in that regard. I agree with you. And for existing fans, all of these things are fine. They're probably happy to add an additional 3 hours because they don't care. But I am conscious of player time as a commodity in a game thing. It's just, I think, good design to be like, time also matters. You have so much of it to use, so don't blow it on things that don't end up mattering or aren't part of the fun part of a game.
If you're doing micromanagement, which gives you nothing except stretching the time, I think you're completely right. But you found an elegant solution to do card-driven war games in 3 hours. So you might find something that it takes 4.5 hours. And if you're going for digital versions, I always realize playing Twilight Struggle on Playdeck or the Red Sea edition, you're very quick playing it. So that comes up because board games are an analog game and an analog hobby, but many hardcore players play digitally as well, and then they are much quicker.
That is for sure.
So you should take in regard that many people are also on the digital side of it. And if you're saying, yeah, a digital version comes sooner or later after we have sold enough copies, I think people are perfectly fine with it. In addition, in game length, because you can save games, you can continue them digitally much more easy than you do it on your living room.
Although maybe this will get us in more trouble. I don't know if you had seen this. I guess you'd have to see it on Board Game Geek or something. But when the Chinese government had decided that Chinese boys were paying too much attention to video games, and they came out with a long list of games that were banned in China, the Playdeck version of Twilight Struggle made the list. Yeah, so, but if we make it longer, we're definitely never getting off the list.
But it's interesting that it's so popular in China as well.
It is, for sure.
And I think we also got the idea about more enhanced versions, because from my opinion, good game design, the quality in terms of level of complexity does not come from the rules, but from the possibilities the rules give you.
That's right.
It's like in Twilight Struggle, where you don't have so many choices in one turn. It's good game design, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So we have asked a lot about Twilight Struggle, but I told you we're doing a bit about the career as well.
Yeah.
You were talking before about 1960 making of the president. So that's Nixon against Kennedy. And there's a personal story. I always wanted to buy the game, and the German edition was out of print. And every time they had it in print, I didn't check. So I have no 1960 until today. But I always was interested in 1960 because I wrote a test paper about it on university in Nuremberg in the 2000s. So that was kind of my topic, about the TV debates and about the changing of the landscape between Democrats and Republicans in that age and the civil rights movement. And I think that's a very interesting area you were doing. And I was realizing that you have done it, not because I was a Twilight Struggle fan, I wanted to have it because the topic was so appealing. And now preparing for our discussion, I was like, well, he has done 1960, I have to ask him about that game as well. So you said you learned a lot for that game, and I would be interested, what kind of experiences did you take from the development of Twilight Struggle into 1960? And can we hope for a digital version? Because I was missing it for 10 years now.
You've had so much exposure to Twilight Struggle. I would really love your impression of 1960 to see
how you think we succeeded on
smoothing over some rough edges. After Twilight Struggle, I think one thing that we learned a lot about was card design, and I avoid as much as I can now in every game since. Any game that has a timing component like Aldrich Ames, I think if you combined all of the errata that has come out on Twilight Struggle, it would be fewer than the questions about how to implement Aldrich Ames under one weird concern after another. And so unless a card has to have a timing component, I do not include them in card driven games because it just creates too many questions and too many weird, unanticipated relationships that I didn't think about before I designed the card. So in 1960, there are no such cards. In some of the other games, there's a little bit of, but not a ton.
For all the listeners, Aldrich Ames is a card about a Soviet counter spy in the US, and he's an event in Twilight Struggle.
Yeah.
What's the timing component? I'm curious.
That card was so bad, we had to rewrite it. You are probably playing with Aldrich Ames Redux.
Yeah, because we have the optional cards and we have a later edition.
Yes, we actually changed the way the card worked because the original one was causing just too much trouble. But in terms of 1960, if Twilight Struggle was trying to introduce wargamers to certain elements of European wargame design, the object of 1960 was exactly the opposite. We're trying to show European board game players what conflict simulations of wargames look like. And so we were taking chunks of interesting parts of wargame design, and in this case, applying them to a US election.
So it has more conflict of deleting units or deleting influence, because in the Twilight games, you can erase influence, but most of the time you stack it up.
Yeah. And so in 1960, it's even a little more tug of war because only one person's influence can be in a space at the same time. So you're either winning a state or you're not. There's no like competing.
Winner takes it all principle.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just part of the nature of the electoral system in the United States. And for a lot of Euro players who are conflict averse, they won't ever try Twilight Struggle, but they all like 1960. And so that's gratifying. And the other weird thing is, while there had been a lot of U.S. presidential election games, almost all of them had been multiplayer games, like 4 or 6 players. Mm. And, you know, it's really a binary experience. We have some minor parties in the United States, but they're not competitive at the presidential scale.
Yeah, I know. Independent candidates have no chance.
Yeah, they don't really have any chance.
Just ruin Al Gore's presidency, but that's all.
Yeah, exactly. They can be spoilers, but they can't win.
Nader.
Exactly.
And we also did not have any election games that were contextualized to a particular election so that you could incorporate the historical events and happenings of a precise election to the event. And so not only is 1960 one of our closest elections in U.S. history, but it also has all of this interesting background happening. As you say, the civil rights movement, the transition from radio to television, the fact that aviation is now a thing and campaigns are just on the back of railroads, but people can get to every part of the country and campaign in every part of the country.
It's much more mobile than other campaigns, which were bound to big cities.
Exactly. This is also, as it sounds like was in your paper, the first time that the Republican Party since the Civil War started playing footsie with the South. And Nixon does that here. And then these days, the South is the base of the Republican Party. So it's flipped 180 from where it had been.
But in 2024, I think California gets weaker regarding the Democrat voters and the Texan people regarding the history since the late 1990s. The Democrats win, but because the winner takes it all, it doesn't play a role that you have 40% of Democrats in Texas instead of 25%.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
And having grown up in California, there were Republican governors most of my life.
Schwarzenegger, Reagan.
Yeah, exactly.
So the red state, blue state thing, it tells a lie. There have always been a lot of Republicans in California, but it's a big state. And so if 60% of them are Democrats, it doesn't matter what the other 40% are.
Correct. And the problem is, like, you could have someone being in a Democratic Party in Nevada being much more conservative than a Republican before Trump in Portland.
Yeah, absolutely true.
So that's a point about the party system as well. I personally think that it should be reformed to have a better election system or a newer one, but I know that the Americans always swear on the 1776 declare of independence and our democracy is the best in the world and everything. And you have some points which are better than other systems, but I think it would be time to reform it. But it won't happen the same with the UK or with some electoral reforms that should be in Italy or maybe even in smaller parts in Germany. That's always when a democracy is founded, you live with it how they have designed it by the first minute.
It's unfortunate and true. I do think there is some additional appetite at the moment for reform of the U.S. electoral system, but I think there is a lot of concern on both sides, both conservatives and liberals, about what would happen if we tried to reconstruct the Constitution to modernize it.
It's not clear how that would go.
Mm. There will always be a loser, and that's why they are fearing it. And if you think about the only hope you have is now the Department of Government Efficiency, that will fix it.
Yes, everyone is feeling much better with those guys running around.
Just trust the richest man on earth, that's fine. He's running the business.
Yeah, it's not a very pleasant time to be in Washington, I'm afraid.
So I'm sure there will be a Netflix series about that area we're living in and about that presidency in 25 years. I'm 100% sure.
Yeah, maybe sooner.
Yeah, the voters have to be dead or the voters do not have to remember everything and say, there were difficult situations and times. And so it can't be their fault, because when you think about the German Nazi movies, they didn't come out in the 50s and 60s. They came out in the late 70s, early 80s, like Das Boot 1981. And even then they had heavy criticism of the population who have fought in the war. And now if you think about movies like Der Untergang, The Downfall, or something like this, It's all after the generation has died. So I think we are setting up perfect television, like your president told to Zelensky, at the moment for the next decades and the generations to come. And we are going to watch it as old men and say, yeah, that's funny. I remember that.
Yeah, it is so sad. But between COVID and the first Trump presidency, if that didn't convince you that there's something wrong with human beings, you're not paying very much attention, I think. Humanity's ability to admit when it makes a mistake is pretty much zero. And it's really not a good thing.
Yeah. You also did a game about post-war time in Germany, 1989, The Dawn of Freedom. That's the subtitle of the game. And it's about the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolvement of the USSR. So I always thought, well, that's very interesting to play. And I wanted to know what motivated you to develop that game, 1989, about the dissolvement of the Eastern Bloc of the Soviet Union.
That one is an interesting story in that, I mean, in every other game I've been involved in, I'm the history guy. I'm the one who does all the reading and usually works on the events because I know what's happening. In that game, Ted had shown me a draft of the game, the co-designer on 1989, mm-hmm. and I thought it was excellent. So really, my job was more like a developer. Actually, there are 15 cards in 1989 that are exactly the same as Twilight Struggle cards. So it's based on the Twilight Struggle system. So my job really was more like making sure that everything worked smoothly together and the game was good.
So do I understand you correctly that you moved into a very late phase or a later phase when 1989 was already in development?
Ted, all by himself, had put together a prototype and wanted to show me, of course, because he was obviously a big Twilight Struggle fan. And I played it and I'm like, this is great. Maybe it needs a little work, but there's a fantastic game here. I called GMT and said,
you guys need to do this. And then
they agreed. And so that's how it came to pass. And then we did development work, maybe a year or so, playtesting and some refinement. We changed how conflict works. This game uses something much more like We the People or Hannibal for conflict resolution. But Ted knew all the history. And even though it's weird, I was alive for all of it and I was kind of paying attention. But
it all happened so quickly.
Within 18 months, the world has changed.
Exactly.
So all of the little detail that's included in 1989, I certainly found it instructive because it linked together a bunch of events that I had not linked together in my head.
So the spark of doing 1989 was set by another person.
Yeah, it wasn't me. It would be logical for me to have been like, oh, let's do something about the actual end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. But yeah, wasn't my idea. Somebody else beat me way to it.
I see. It was published a few years after Twilight Struggle. The distance between both games isn't too big regarding the history.
Yeah, that's right.
You were working together with Ananda Gupta after 10 years of pausing, your perfect combination of creating Twilight Struggle. So why did you have such a long pause and what brought you back to the game Imperial Struggle?
I alluded to this problem earlier. Twilight Struggle came out, and of course, naturally enough, we were like, okay, we should do something else. This is going well. But as I mentioned, Ananda ended up working for a video game company with this very difficult IP clause, so that if we'd published a game together with his name on it, they would have had some claim to the rights of it.
Mm-hmm.
We began the design of Imperial Struggle. We had initial conversations shortly after Twilight Struggle. But it took 8 years, and then Ananda switched jobs, moved to California, and we were finally able to finish the work on Imperial Struggle and then running it around for playtesting and whatever.
Okay, but the main reason was really his job, nothing else.
We didn't have a breakup and weren't talking like Sonny and Jerry or something. It was
okay. It's not an Ike and Tina story. It's more...
Yeah. Ananda's definitely Ike, though.
You just got the name and she got the money from you. I see. Looking at the Twilight Struggle map, you have the global setting very clear to your eyes. And playing Imperial Struggle, you have the problem that you have certain areas of the world shown in some kind of info boxes on the mounted map. So what was the reason to decide for having theater boxes instead of having a global map? I can imagine reasons why, but I think the card isn't so appealing on the first look when you place your counters.
When Ananda and I were casting around for what we would do next in terms of a Twilight Struggle kind of game, there are only a handful of rivalries in the world that are of the same scope and scale as the United States and Soviet Union, and clearly England and France are one of them.
Or England and Spain or something like this. If you go earlier.
You could do a couple of others. England and Spain.
To a certain extent, although England is really a peewee compared to Spain for most of that.
Yeah, that's true. You'd have to go to the 16th century, otherwise it makes no sense.
Right. Oh, Austria, Prussia. Like, there are a handful of things, but there are not a ton of them. And so we settled on England and France. And to a certain extent, historians call this the Second Hundred Years' War. And it really follows not that far on the heels of the First Hundred Years' War. We didn't really want to do medieval history and England and France that way, figuring out who was England and who was France. This is about England is England and France is France, and what does that end up meaning? So the map is kind of the way it is because of the geography of the nature of the conflict. Yes, there are trading posts already in England and France and Africa, but for the most part, early exploration of Africa is the Portuguese, not these guys.
Oh, yes.
And so you have to get Africa out of the way.
If you are in the late 18th century, 19th century, earlier, then you'll have to bring it in. But I think the phase is end of 18th century, beginning of 19th century. And so India and North America are the spots you'll have to fight, or Southeast Asia.
Exactly. And the Caribbean.
Yeah.
So that it's really just a function of where historically the competition was taking place and how can you craft a map that is coherent, but
leaves out certain parts of the world.
Precisely.
I see. Well, that's the explanation I had as well. I was a bit curious about that game before playing it, but I think you can see the origins of Twilight Struggle as well.
Yeah, I mean, it plays extraordinarily differently than Twilight Struggle, but in scope and scale, it's similar. It also has a little bit this sandbox thing where you can start placing influence in the world wherever you like, and you'll figure it out eventually what's dangerous and what's okay.
Talking about the projects that come up, I found a game that is called US versus Aaron Burr. I haven't heard about it before the research. Maybe you can share a few sentences with us what the game is about.
You know, Aaron Burr has kind of become a little bit worldwide famous because of the Hamilton musical, and he plays an important role. And
I do not know the person.
So Aaron Burr is one of the founding fathers. In fact, in some regards, he's the most purebred of the founding fathers because his ancestry goes back to the early pilgrims and important figures in the founding. Most of the rest of the founding fathers, as we refer to them, are kind of relative newcomers.
They didn't come with the Mayflower.
Yeah, they didn't come with the Mayflower. But Aaron Burr's family does. And he's an important Revolutionary War officer. And he's in the rival camp against George Washington. There was kind of like an attempted coup to replace George Washington by a rival general.
So something like a revolt within the Independence War.
Yeah, kind of. Of course, they were trying to use Congress to do it politically, but you get the idea.
Something like a plot.
Exactly. And so Burr is kind of associated with that. Alexander Hamilton is on the other side. But they are initially friends, but they both live in New York State and they become intense political rivals. Hamilton is extraordinarily close to George Washington and Aaron Burr feels snubbed by George Washington. Aaron Burr feels like he's superior breeding to all these other founding fathers. So how dare they be the ones who get blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
So this starts out a sequence of events that's portrayed in the Hamilton musical where Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr indulge in a duel. Alexander Hamilton is the vice president of the United States of America, and he kills Alexander Hamilton in that duel. That's where the musical ends. Then things get really weird, and most Americans don't even know this is true. But Aaron Burr, as the vice president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson drops him like a hot potato because now he's killed another founding father. You know, we can't have him as the vice president.
Yeah.
So during the next election, Thomas Jefferson throws him overboard.
He has a burn notice on him.
Exactly. And Thomas Jefferson decides to acquire the Louisiana Purchase
from Napoleon, Mississippi area, Louisiana.
Yeah, precisely.
So Aaron Burr is this notable human being, and he thinks he's going to put together a body of adventurers, sail down to New Orleans, and declare himself king. And this might even work because New Orleans is like a slaveholding area, and they're already concerned.
You see the seeds for the secession war already.
Precisely. So he goes down. It's kind of a comedy of errors. Thomas Jefferson hears rumors about this. this, and federal troops are dispatched to stop him. And finally, he's actually found and caught. And then Thomas Jefferson, who again had been his running mate for president, puts him on trial for treason in Richmond, Virginia.
So death penalty could happen.
Death penalty could happen, would happen, if he had found guilty of treason. But he gets off. He wins his court case.
Ah, so that's what you're playing in the game, the court case. So you'll have to know all the background you told us, and then you can play guilty or not guilty. That's funny, but that's a very American topic.
It is a very American topic, but since presidential treason is all the rage here in the United States, it's a very topical subject for a game.
Is it a court game, bringing in evidence or having someone being left off the hook?
This will be a courtroom game for sure.
Oh, nice.
Another really clever game that I liked, and I tried to convince the author of that game to do this with me since I was kind of stealing his idea. But he designed a game on another very obscure subject, which is called High Treason, The Trial of Louis Riel.
You'll have to explain who is that.
Exactly, of course. No one would know.
Because this is Canadian history, so even more obscure than American history. The British, when they conquered Canada, they set aside all of these special protections for what they call First Peoples, like Native Americans in Canada. So that system between the British and the Native American tribes worked reasonably well. But the difficulty was that the Canadian population also had a ton of people who were, wait, they have a special term for this, but I'm not going to be able to think of it. But anyway, they're half Indian, half European in origin.
And so there are
a lot of these people in India, but they're left out of the constitutional structure. So they don't have the privileges of European settlers, and they don't have the privileges of Native American people.
So they are in the limbo state.
Exactly. So Louis Riel is one of those people. He leads a successful revolt against the British government in, I think, Manitoba province or something like that. The British have to come to the negotiating table. They work out some agreement, and Louis Riel decides to flee to the United States just for safekeeping. Then fast forward, whatever it is, let's say 5 or 10 years, and he thinks that the British are not living up to their agreement. He comes back to Canada to lead a second revolt, which sounds like a good idea. But in the interim, the British have built their own transcontinental railroad. So when he starts a revolt, the British troops show up like that, and they crush the revolt, and they nab him.
Agility and mobility.
Yeah, exactly. And they put him on trial for treason. So now his case turns out much worse. He is hung.
Okay.
The idea of that, I was like, oh, we have this amazing treason trial in the United States that most people don't even know existed.
So will you do a case where O.J. Simpson will be guilty?
If O.J. Simpson was vice president of the United States, I definitely would do it.
It is an exciting drama, though, and that would be a good game for sure. Give it a few more years, O.J. will be ready.
100% to have him not guilty is the most incredible thing.
Yeah, super easy, as it turns out.
It sounds very interesting, but I can't imagine how it works card-driven. So is it more like a Cluedo game, or does it have elements of the card-driven war games? Or is it more like, yeah, it has a completely different mechanic because it doesn't work otherwise with a jury or with a quad setting?
So to talk about Louis Riel a little bit, one of the most interesting parts of that game is there's a process in the law, in Commonwealth law, same for British in the United States, where we have voir dire, which is the process by which we choose a jury. And for the
case of Louis Riel, there's an interesting mechanism that he has used,
because French jurors are more pro Louis Riel and
the English are against it.
And so one of the elements of his game is you're trying to figure out who's what kind of person so you can get the right people on the jury so that then you can win. Some element of that will be true. But I think for both games, the thing is there's still an influence game, just like Twilight Struggle, but instead of influencing countries, you're influencing jurors. And then you have evidence, testimony, biases, historical context, all of those for event cards that are shifting jurors one way or the other.
If this game works out, you can do the O.J. Simpson game, and you can do the game about Clinton and Monica Lewinsky as well.
Yes, for sure. An endless series of legal games.
I think that's an interesting subgenre and topic to talk about. I like deductive games also. Maybe there are some elements that can help you to have some sort of idea. Has he done it or hasn't he done it? So that might add some flavor to it.
Some element, yeah.
Yeah, sounds interesting. So talking about your current projects, when can we expect US versus Aaron Burr? And when can we expect Asian Monsoon?
So the first of the three projects is the anniversary edition, and South Asian Monsoon cannot come out until after the anniversary edition has been out for a few minutes.
I see. Yeah, sure.
I mean, we'll have the anniversary edition this year and we should have it by summer. So most likely, I think South Asian Monsoon will be pushed to the first quarter of next year.
2026.
Yeah. So the Fourth Circle lineup is filled through 2026. So I'm guessing Aaron Burr will come out probably mid-2026.
Mm-hmm. So there will be two games published in 2026, maybe early and late 2026.
Yeah.
Do you have projects and ideas for after that already? Or when does that develop?
That's the way of things now. It wasn't always this way, but publishers producing so many games at the moment, and I don't know how long this will last or whether sanctions and Chinese nonsense is going to slow the rates of publication at some point in time. But even if they cut it in half, publishers will still be backlogged for quite some time before they get through their current commitments.
But yeah, I've already
got three projects that are no more than notional, but one publisher or another has asked for something that I'm taking notes and will get into work on as soon as these other things are done.
These projects you have backlogged, are these all in the Jason Matthews style, which you have implemented over the years, beginning with Twilight Struggle, or will you do something completely different?
I'm definitely in favor of doing something completely different, and some of the things that I'm working on would be different for sure. But I would be lying to say that the publishers who approach me,
they're always like,
"Can you give us Twilight Struggle in this?"
That's kind of their pitch.
Of course.
I don't like doing exactly the same game again, and so whatever I do is going to be a little different. I'm not just going to reskin Twilight Struggle. And I always, when I start a game, I start with the approach of trying to learn enough about whatever the subject is that I'm modeling the elements that I think are interesting or fun to play.
But it will be with historical background.
Well, I have been approached by people who own some very famous intellectual property about doing a game for them. It would be a little more in the Twilight Struggle milieu. It'll play a little more like that, but it'll be IP that you're well familiar with and sort of has history, but it's not real history.
Do you have something like a project or a scenario about a game which you really have liked to do, but you couldn't for some reason, apart from the Spanish Civil War?
Yeah, so I actually had designed a game on Versailles, and I honestly thought it was an interesting game, but the publisher I pitched it to initially sat on it for a while and didn't love it, and then I got onto some other project and put it aside, and then when I dusted it off, it was no longer state of the art, and then shortly thereafter, the Versailles game that is quite good from Mark Herman and Jeff came out, and I don't think the game needs to exist anymore.
You can do something about the peace treaty with Ukraine, maybe. If you still have it.
Yeah, or the US-Panama peace treaty that we'll need shortly.
Yeah.
Or Greenland. Red, white, and blue land.
The gentleman who designed Race for the Galaxy.
Vlada Čvatić.
Yeah. And he's somebody who has just a ton of designs and had worked on a variety of them. And he was like, sometimes games fall out of the state of the art. They were great ideas when you worked on them, but they stopped being good ideas
5 or 6 years later. And I think all of us have played games that are
fond in our memory in our childhood. But if you take them out again right now, you're like, yeah, this isn't that good. This other game does 3/4 of what this game does, but also does these other interesting things. And that just, as it turns out, part of the creative process.
Yeah, sometimes you might be too late or someone comes up earlier that can happen to you. I've played a game called Europe Divided, and that was too late after Twilight Struggle has happened. So sometimes people miss the sweet spot.
Yeah, David Thompson, the designer of Europe Divided, and I are friends, and I admire games that he's designed, and he is a prolific, very successful game designer. But of course, when you come out with that game, it's just going to end up being compared to Twilight Struggle.
Right.
And I'm not saying his game is not better than Twilight Struggle, but you're just going to have to be prepared for you're operating in exactly the same space with a very similar mechanism.
Without adding a unique feature, that was the problem, I think. But it's a good game.
Yeah.
But that's the gold standard. We all have limited time for playing games. That's what you yourself said. So I think that's always the very thing you'll have to face.
For similar reasons, like I will never be a guy who designs a game about Stalingrad. You know, I think there are excellent war games already on Stalingrad, and I don't have anything interesting additional to say about it. So why am I going to do a game about it? Which is not to discourage anybody from doing another East Front game, but unless you have something more interesting to say about it than Ted Ricier or any of these other prominent designers in that space, go find some other topic.
Which games, including your own, would you recommend to players who enjoy Twilight Struggle? So you can also name some game experiences which were great from other designers where you say, well, that's definitely a recommendation if you are into wargaming.
Well, I highly recommend Treason, the Trial of Louis Riel. It is such a weird topic, such an interesting piece of history. No one knows about it, so go track it down. It is a card-driven game, so if you like card-driven games, the basic mechanism of it will be familiar, just the setting is totally off the wall. I also, in the kind of like Twilight Struggle, but different, and I think is super clever, is Wir sind das Volk, which takes the Twilight Struggle system and applies it in a way I would never even have occurred to me, to be honest, to do the two competing economic systems between West Germany and East Germany. I really admire that design. There may be some balance questions there, but who cares? The play experience is well worth having. In terms of foundational games, which it sounds like maybe you haven't played, Mark Herman's We the People, which was then rechanged to Washington's War, is the first card-driven game ever. It was the thing that reignited my interest in war games away from Euro games, and so I'm forever thankful for it. And it's quite an entertaining game about the American Revolution anyway. Mm.
Yeah, they have very good critiques, but we do not have a very good access to American games here in Europe, and they are always costly and they are time consuming. So that's why we have just a bunch of them, not a complete set.
Right. To mention one of my own, which is a little bit off the beaten path, but if you are a Euro game player who wants a card-driven experience, I have a game, again, designed with Christian called Founding Fathers. It's about the adoption of the American Constitution in 1789, and it's the only game that I have published that you can do with multiplayers, and we were very focused on the problems of multiplayer conflict simulation games. Like how to keep a card-driven game where everybody's got to read text down to like 2 hours so you don't end up, not to be critical of Here I Stand, but there's a lot of downtime and a lot of multiplayer card-driven games and they take forever. So we were very focused on addressing those concerns in Founding Fathers. And so I think it's a good design for that reason, particularly if you're like, oh, I'd like to try this out, but I'm really a Euro gamer and I'm always playing with 4 or 5 people.
Card-driven war games aren't a big topic in the German player scene, so that's more niche or subgenre. And one title which was becoming well-known or which has some press appearances in journals, which 100,000 people reading it every week, that was Weimar, the Fight for Democracy, done by Matthias Kramer, where you have 4 parties playing the communists, the Nazis, the Social Democratic Party, and the center, that's the Christian Democratic Union, the predecessor, and you'll have to stay successfully in time of Weimar. And it's card driven and it was in the press and they said, yeah, it's very good historical accuracy and has a lot of options and it is well designed, but I haven't played it yet. But it looks like the games you have recommended as well within the card driven war game spots.
I'm glad you raised that game. Unlike
Larry Harris, I play a ton of games and I have played Weimar Republic.
And what is your opinion?
It is a beautifully produced and a fantastic gaming experience. It's more of a time commitment.
It's longer, yes.
Yeah, but I really admire that design very, very much. And it was interesting because it's not a Euro design in the sense it has little fiddly rules like an American war game.
But what's so cool about that game is that
most of what he's simulating is accessible. It's not hidden under mechanics. You know exactly what he's trying to say with the piece and what he's doing with it. Matthias came out to a convention in California where I was also in attendance. And so I was very happy to meet him personally and say how much I admired that game. And I hadn't realized it before, but he has been stealing little things from my game. So I guess it's all one big happy family.
If you're looking at his predecessor game, Watergate, where you'll have to judge Nixon, is he guilty or not? And you play 5 rounds, 20 minutes. I think that's a very slick approach on this genre. And Alexander and me have played it a lot. And the outcome is really 50-50 if Nixon gets off the hook or if he's resigning. And I think that's the opposite side of the Weimar 6 to 8 hour gameplay. You just can do it in 25 minutes. So he has designed both ways.
Yeah, I'm jealous of both of those designs. I mean, Watergate is so inside my wheelhouse, but I probably wouldn't have thought to tackle it in the way he did. And I think it's super clever.
For sure.
When you're talking about designing games for two players or for multiplayer groups, I know that GMT games like to have solitaire modes in their game. And Twilight Struggle, for example, does not have one. How do you feel in general about solitary modes? Because we have never played one of these war games in solitary mode. We always have the feeling that they are not designed to be played single-handedly. And maybe a publisher wants a single-player mode, then he gets a design for it, but actually it's not the experience how it's meant for. How do you feel about that?
I'll try not to go on a rant because I don't want to offend people who prefer to play solitaire games. And obviously, we talked a little bit earlier about Mark Herman's Pacific War. And I really think that most people who play Pacific War are playing it by themselves. Maybe they play both sides, but they leave it set up at a desk.
Fobbier.
Yeah. What could be possibly wrong with that? Or GMT's Mr. President, which is also a longer design and a similar experience, I think, for most players. I don't believe in solitaire gaming anymore. I think the hobby as a whole has gone to all this trouble to find and develop tools for players to identify each other, to play with each other online, find each other at conventions. And I get that we are a hobby of well-educated introverts, but gaming is a social activity. And I want people to go find opponents, find friends, or make new friends from playing games together. That's one of the most important dynamics of the hobby.
I think you're absolutely right, because when you want to play solo games, you just turn on your computer and you get the thing you want to have. Then play Gary Grigsby's War in the East or something like this. If you're really into hardcore war gaming and you can have a challenging computer system. So I think it's always clunky playing on the board a solitaire mode. And that's why we never were attracted by this.
I was a little bewildered when I saw these games having a solitary mode. Like, surprised, why do these games have one? Is there such a high demand for that?
It is. It's purely a demand thing. And it's gotten to the point where the economics of a game have difficulty if they do not include a solitaire mode, even though I think it's personally, to me, a little bit nonsense.
So we agree on that, but the people ask for it.
Right. So Red Sea has a solitaire mode. I didn't design it. South Asian Monsoon will probably have a solitaire mode. I have a couple of ideas for how I would like to try to design a solitaire game. But in my heart of hearts, I don't think that's what gaming is all about. Of course, I can respect somebody who's like, well, I want to play through the game so I can understand it and then teach it. That makes perfect sense to me.
Sequence of plays are fine.
Yeah, but in general, not my thing.
For Twilight Struggle, you haven't been requested to design one?
People bring it up all the time. If they're waiting for me to design it,
they will be dead and I will be dead before it's done.
That's fine. I won't miss it.
I was just curious about the topic because Twilight Struggle doesn't have one.
So how much time do you invest in playing other games? Because you still have to design your own ones.
And playtest them.
Yeah. So how much chunk of a time does it take you to live your hobby? Because you have a regular job, you have a family, you design games, and you play other games, which are time consuming. If you play Weimar or We the People or something, you spend hours. So now my question is, how do you organize that without having too much trouble with your wife?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can sleep when you're dead, I guess. It's fine. It used to be that I had a regular weekend group, and things have to give eventually when you get so busy. And so I don't meet every weekend like I used to. And I do a lot more play online than I used to, just to make sure that I can have some gaming experiences and try certain things on my own time scale whenever I can squeeze in the time. But when a game starts getting a buzz and it sounds like it's doing something interesting, I make a point of tracking it down either at a convention or with one of my friends so that I can get it played and see what it's doing and see if what it's doing is interesting and I can derive any lesson from the way it was approached.
All design is kind of iterative. All design is standing on other people's good work. So for that reason, I really do think it's important for me to see what other people are up and how it might apply to a conflict that I'm trying to simulate.
Hmm.
Frequently, it's going to come from some sort of Euro who is not the least concerned about the War of Spanish Succession. But there's something clever that this designer has done that
I think, you know, applies.
This element you can use.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just a question which wasn't on my list, but I think those game mechanics are pretty unique and he's using it all over his games, most of them. Have you played a game of MacGurts, like Imperial or Navigador or Colonia?
I love Imperial and the Imperial system. I see he has a new thing coming out, his Rondel approach to game design. Super clever. I met him in Italy, I guess.
I played a bunch of MacGurts things.
I always think that could be combined with a card-driven war game, that Rondel.
Yeah, it absolutely could.
That doesn't exist yet, so maybe there's an idea to come up with a combination of those two elements.
Yeah, there you go. You've solved my latest design problem.
I will send you the invoice later on.
Send me the invoice for sure.
That was a spontaneous question, but we asked Larry Harris about, hey, you're balancing your games. He has a lot of dice rolled. So we said, do you do this with mathematics or how do you balance it out? And he said, yeah, he's using a bit mathematics, but most of the thing is like he has to feel it. And we were like, okay, that's a strange approach on dice relying games. So how important is it for you to have the correct mathematics on action points on your cards? Action points the events have. Dice rolls, let's say, for a revolution in Twilight Struggle or in any other game. So how is your approach within the game development on mathematics?
I guess my approach is somewhere between a crazy mathematic guy who does everything by spreadsheet and Larry's. I obviously am counting all the operations points. I count the operations points on an event, like, okay, how many operations points would this event have? I try to balance the card and its operations points, and then how many operations points in the early war are there available to the Americans versus the Soviets, and all of that math was done. I knew all of those numbers.
So how did you rate the stars which are divided white-red, which could be for both sides?
Well, so there's the part where it gets a little bit more like art and less like math.
Yeah.
Does it feel okay? And sometimes events feel either not strong enough or too strong, and you're like, okay, well, I have to take an operations point away from this, or this needs a little boost some kind of way. And that just comes from playtesting. If there's another better way to do it, I don't know what it is. So the feel thing that Larry's talking about is definitely for real. But I was talking to another designer who had read some book about creativity, and he was saying that at a subconscious level, when you're in a design process, your brain is kind of doing some of that math for you. And that's why this thing that Larry's describing about feeling your way through play balance, it's maybe not as magical or weird as it sounds, because somewhere in the back of your brain,
it works all the time in the back of your brain.
Yeah,
it's understandable that you have to rely on your feeling somehow, because for the Twilight Struggle example, you have to judge for every card. How much is it worth when I have it in my hand? What is when the opponent has it in his hand? It's completely different.
Yeah.
Or is it shot to the moon?
Yeah.
So this is where you just have to rely on your feeling, because you cannot do all the math there. I mean, obviously it would be possible with modern computers, but not if you're a game designer. You have to be a computer and mathematics scientist.
Precisely.
You're covering a lot of historical themes and you do not step back if you are interested in a theme like US versus Aaron Burr. But do you have a favorite epoch where you would say, I will design sooner or later a game in the ancient time, in the medieval time, about Europe, about Asia, about the exploration, about the 21st century? Do you have something where you say, well, this is a spot I will visit sooner or later for sure?
That's a super interesting question. I am like a historical dilettante. I tend to want to read things about subjects I don't know very much about. And then that always inspires like an idea for a game design. They're not all good ideas, but you know, it gets that part of my brain working. I know quite a bit about the Napoleonic Wars. I've read a lot about the Napoleonic Wars. And so I would like to find something, not necessarily trying to tackle the entirety of the Napoleonic Wars, but some discrete part of them and simulate that. In addition, some people are kind of frustrated about the design of Imperial Struggle because a culmination of the rivalry between England and France is Waterloo. And the Napoleonic Wars are not in Imperial Struggle. But the reason that they're not in Imperial Struggle is a rather good one, to be honest, for play balance sake. After Trafalgar, the French cannot defend their colonies anymore. So if you incorporated Trafalgar, which you would have to in any game about Napoleonic history, then it would make it very uninteresting after then. So anyway, someday, somehow, I will do something about the Napoleonic Wars.
Well, that's an interesting scale to work on. So you can check Imperial Borders because they have the end of the war and the hidden movement and everything. So I'm very interested in this one coming up in 2025 as well.
Me too. I'm excited for it. I don't remember where I came across that Larry was doing something on the Napoleonic Wars, but it automatically piqued my interest.
Yeah, you might have seen it on our channel.
Yeah, that's right.
You just had to watch 3 hours and then he was talking about Imperial Borders. So Napoleonic Wars will be revisited by you. And do you think in a card-driven way or maybe something different coming up?
I have a weird concept that I think works best for the Napoleonic Wars that I want to explore somewhere. Maybe this won't be the thing, but it could be the place where I get into it. But I just think that most war games lack exploration of command perspective and communication from command down to their subordinates.
You also mean the delay of information?
Delay of information, the incompleteness of information, and I think it warps the experience of wargaming because if you told a commander of a modern army, but any army, the location of the enemy, what precisely their strength is, what precisely your own strength is, and what is the range of potential outcomes if those two armies combat, you have eliminated all the work. You've given a general everything that they possibly need to know to be successful. And that is not what the experience of command is about.
In a tactical situation, it isn't that way. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not that way at all. Even the grand strategic situation for most of it.
Today, it is more difficult because of the satellite system. But if you're thinking about the World War I situation, it's that way. And in World War II, even then, the scouting is not the right word.
Reconnaissance and intelligence, right?
Yeah, it was terrible on the German side about the Soviets, for example.
Yeah, precisely. And earlier than that,
capitals didn't know the outcome of battles for weeks after the effect. And so there's always this drag in command and control. So I think that needs to be simulated somewhere so that part of warfare, that idea that you're in command, you are placing yourself in the role of Napoleon or Wellington, whomever you want it to be, that you're actually making the decisions that were available to them to given the information that they were aware of. I want a war game about that.
One thing that comes to my mind spontaneously is not the wargaming scenario, but maybe something like America's Most Wanted, like hunt Osama bin Laden or do some serial killers in US and find them. So that would be something where you rely on hidden information and you'll have to access it somewhere to get on the trace of the people. But it's a very dark subject.
Yeah, for sure.
Someone has wanted me to design a game about Herbert Hoover and the FBI, and I may get around to that sometime. But that'll be more of a political conflict between Hoover and Kennedy.
Don't forget that he saved the money for World War II.
Yes, and that he liked to dress in drag, but that's a different problem.
But he has the Hoover Dam. At least his name stands forever as a successful president. We have asked a lot of questions out of the box already, so you're very much into history. So if you could invite a historical figure to a dinner, who would it be and why?
I think given what I know, it would be impossible to not say Churchill just because he's such a witty conversationalist and he loved to drink and eat to excess.
And smoke.
Yeah, and smoke. So if you want to have a good time, I think it's Winston Churchill.
He's not necessarily
my favorite historical figure, but he is a really good one and a really witty one.
You would have a good evening.
Yeah, for sure.
Churchill has a well-written biography and he's well-researched in history and he didn't keep his opinion a lot of time disclosed. So who would you like to meet for answering questions?
Well, that relates to this game very well.
Aaron Burr.
Aaron Burr. And what is so sad about Aaron Burr is that we would know a ton more about him because he had all of this correspondence that he kept with his daughter. He was a very progressive Frello in a certain sense that he wanted his daughter highly educated and she spoke all of these languages and whatever. But in any event, he wrote to her constantly. And so we know all of his innermost thoughts about his betrayal of the country and all of these historical figures who he had all these interactions mm-hmm. with. He wrote it all down. He sent it all to his daughter, and his daughter died at sea, and all of those letters were lost. And so there are a lot of secrets about Aaron Burr.
But it wasn't to his disadvantage because he was kind of a free man, so.
Yeah.
Exactly. And if all that correspondence had existed, he might have been actually hung, but it doesn't. So I would love to talk to him and get a little more insight into what he thought he was doing and why.
Yeah, Aaron Burr is kind of a new figure to me after that podcast. Do you have a special story from a convention? Did you have some meeting where you say, wow, that was really interesting and that changed my view on game design or on my hobby, or that was a really other view I have normally about designing games or approaching things? So can you share a story in that way with us?
At this stage, I've been so lucky to meet almost everyone of real fame in game design, either from the European side or American war gamers. And I am especially grateful for the fact that I have met a lot of, to coin the phrase, like founding fathers from the wargaming era before they passed. And they are unfortunately passing rather quickly at the moment. We lost Roger McGowan, who is maybe the most famous wargaming artist of all time. He designed the cover of Twilight Struggle and 600 other gaming covers. And he was kind enough to sit down and have lunch with me and regale me with all of these stories about the early days of the hobby and his influences. He himself worked at an ad agency in California. And so he had done all of these science fiction covers for movies and magazines. That Twilight Struggle cover, which doesn't look very much like Squad Leader or one of his other famous wargame covers, we had a chat about it and he was harking back to his sci-fi days and the movie poster work and stuff he was doing in the 1950s. And when he said that to me, I immediately was like, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. And then I understood exactly what he was trying to do with the Twilight Struggle cover and have loved it ever since. You know, Mark Herman, who was the guy who reignited my interest in wargaming and invented the card-driven system, he and I are like buddies now. We chit-chat on text and whatever, so that's all fantastic. I think the person who I have learned the most from, honestly, is Volker Runke. And
that is at least in part because I appear on so many panels with him. We're both in DC.
We're both kind of roughly the same age. We've had a weird career path. I have one crazy Volko story. I'd known Volko for years. I was a playtester on Wilderness War, which is one of his early famous successful designs about the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War in the United States. Anyway, I had no idea what he did. He never talked about it. And spies never talk about their job, as you know. But I worked in the U.S. Senate, and my member of the Senate was a member of the Armed Services Committee. So one day we're going to a SCIF, which is a secure location where you can talk about classified information. And my boss is going to take a brief from the CIA on something going on with the Second Gulf War. And so I walk in with my boss, and they're sitting to give a brief is Volko Runke and his boss. And I'm like, Volko?
That's funny.
But Volko, because he was an educator at the CIA, you know, he started as an analyst and then ultimately moved into the education field, and he designed all of these games as an educator to help train CIA agents and analysts over there using gaming. He has a lot of interesting ideas about how modeling works, what level of complexity to use to model certain things, and just hearing him speak about it has helped solidify certain things in my own design approach. And so I'm very grateful for that.
I see. So you have influences from different directions regarding art style, regarding gameplay, narrowing things down, and you have your own ideas, and that mix is now impersonated in your personal game designing style.
For sure.
What was the quirkiest comment you've received about one of your games?
One of my friends who is a game designer got very upset about his first zero on BoardGameGeek.
Not a zero, it's a one.
Yeah.
So it made me laugh a little, and I went back and copied as many ones as I could from Twilight Struggle and just like the insane things that people have to say about Twilight Struggle and pasted it back to him and be like, you know, don't worry about it. It's not that serious and it doesn't end up impacting you. But half of the crazy things that I have read people say about Twilight Struggle make me wonder if they've actually played the game.
You mean the 1, 2, 3 ratings?
Yeah, exactly. Those folks.
There's a kind of person who feels like it's their job to police the Board Game Geek ratings. And I can't imagine what level of psychosis is necessary for you to think that that's your role in the world. But they're out there.
Bad jobs for everybody.
For sure.
That's a funny story as well, but you didn't mention the name of the person you sent it to.
Yeah, that's true. It was Harold Buchanan, I think, and he was complaining about his first one on Flashpoint.
What question have you never been asked but would love to answer?
Well, I don't know how to phrase this as a question, but there's one thing that I'm super proud of in Imperial Struggle that I feel like is overlooked. People don't see it or they don't care, whatever it is, but I like it. It was really our motivation for the whole design of Imperial Struggle. Most war games are about getting certain victory hexes or you score so many points and the game is over. And no war game, other than, as far as I'm concerned, Imperial Struggle, show you the relationship between war and peace. Like, why do I want that hex with a star on it? Because that hex of the star on it helps you dominate some economic thing, that happens in the peace. And that is why, in the case of England and France, there are so many wars over the same set of islands or the same little nub of India or the same little piece of Europe that is the site of one battle after another over history. And
I think that that is a cool thing about Imperial Struggle.
Imperial Struggle lays all of that bare, so you understand exactly why it's important to understand
to hold that location.
You don't have to ask yourself about this. That's something like an inner motivation to conquer those points.
Precisely.
Nice. So another question which came up while talking about the board games, where do you store them?
Oh my God, it's such a mess.
I'm really curious because some people always sell them when they have played them a bunch of times, but I guess you keep them.
I'm somewhere in between. I don't know what to tell you. It is a problem that I'm constantly struggling with because real estate is very expensive in Washington, so I can't just keep buying larger houses to store more board games. I'm happy to say that
my local library has decided to open up
a board game section. So I've been taking games to the library. I also have started kind of a rule where if something's in the shrink wrap and I haven't played it after a couple of years, I know I'm never going to get to it. So I'd need to figure out a way to get rid of it. But yes, I do collect war games and I probably have, let's say, 800 of them.
800.
Yeah.
That's a lot. You have a full room.
Exactly. It's too much.
I was on a mode where I promised myself if I got one, I would get rid of one.
That doesn't work.
It doesn't always work, yeah.
I can understand why. My cupboard is also discussable for my wife, yeah.
Yeah. 800 is a huge number. I didn't expect that.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's
Euro and war games, I should say.
Okay. Mm.
But maybe an undercount because I also have all these magazine war games from, you know, the early 80s and 90s. So
you kept them? Oh, you have a problem.
Okay. So in terms of rules, if you know one, you can play any and you just have to adjust a little, or for every game, you have to understand the mechanisms and the rules and the exceptions and everything. Yeah.
It is helpful to have shorthand to be able to reference, well, it's like this game, but with this exception. And to a certain extent, with classical war games, you can just ask certain questions and dive in, like, how does zones of control work? Are there zones of control? What's the movement rate on these kinds of terrain? Do I have to stop when I blah, blah, blah? But otherwise, everything else is the same and you just roll on the CRT. But also, it's just useful to have played so many different kinds of games because everything seems a little bit familiar. This is not an alien experience, even if
I have to learn some new rules.
Most of the things are common known for you, but you need to know how they work specifically in that game.
Precisely.
But also, I also have to ask, have you played A World at War? And is it actually playable?
I have not played it. I'm embarrassed to say that I own it.
I haven't gotten rid of it just because it has good reputation, and I thought, now it'll be hard to get.
Yes, that's why I bought it. Alex, what kind of complexity does it have?
It says it has complexity level of 8 out of 9. I wonder if any game has 9 out of 9 then.
Oh my lord.
So the problem was, like, we have played the North Africa scenario, and the North Africa scenario was playable. But then they had the rule book, and Alexander read it, not me. And he said, it's so confusing. And they are telling you about page 18 has on page 223 a second exceptional rule, but that could take an event, which is on page 300.
It's the worst rule book I've ever read.
It was enjoyable playing North Africa, but having the campaign or the Eastern Front is absolutely unrealistic.
Maybe also if someone would explain the rules to you, but not from the rule book. The rule book is so inefficient. It looks nice, it has nice pictures and everything, but it's just inefficient. You cannot play the game from reading the rule book.
So it's always funny to me, for a game like this that I've picked up based on its reputation and the fact that I thought it was going to be impossible to find later. All of this acclaim, it's hard to tell whether other people are trying to trick you into buying it, or whether they're just proud of themselves for figuring it out and therefore think it's the greatest game of all time. But it sounds like it would be too painful for me to figure out as well.
I think always, you know how many comments normally and ratings are given to war games. And if it's ridiculously below that number, I'm always skeptic. Because when 18 people say that's the greatest game ever invented, I'm like, okay, if there is two zeros behind those 18 people, I will have a look at it.
Yeah.
Have you played Downfall of the Third Reich, which is a game by Chad Jensen and Mark Simonich?
I have not played Downfall of the Third Reich, but Chad Jensen I know, and I've played a number of his games, and I would trust anything he designed.
Okay. It has no mounted map on the first edition.
They did a mounted map eventually, didn't they?
Yeah, they did for €45 the map and €50 the game.
That's a lot of money.
So you see the problem I have.
I do see the problem you have.
Well, then before Alexander asks the final question about Twilight Struggle, I would like to thank you for the interview, because I've learned from J.D. Vance that you always have to say thank you when you talk to an American people as a European. And before becoming more serious, is there anything else you would like to share with our audience?
Well, thank you all for this opportunity to talk to you. It's been a fantastic interview. This may be the longest interview I've ever given.
We tend to do very long interviews, yeah.
So that's exciting, and the questions were really entertaining. And so thank you both, you and Alex, for the opportunity to speak about all of this. I don't know anything else that I have to say that's too pressing, but other than to say I'm very excited about our hobby and where it's going and how it's growing. And I really often tell my colleagues in European design that I'm afraid that the Euro gaming part of the hobby has hit a little bit of a design brick wall. And all of the interesting innovation is occurring in wargaming. And I have a number of friends who were very serious Eurogamers who have stopped playing Eurogames and have switched over to wargaming.
That's a stagnation.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's great that historical game design is being able to use all of these lessons that we are stealing from our European counterparts and apply them to not just war games, but other kinds of games about history that help teach these lessons and convey these stories in ways that are accessible to players.
Yeah, that's an interesting outlook for the future. I think the wargaming niche is steadily growing. Also in Europe, some prejudices about playing wargames have been overcome already, but they are not common in our stores. So if you want to have an American designed game, you'll have to go to certain publishers and they have a low number of copies, and you have trouble organizing your hobby the way you want to if you're into wargaming over here.
No doubt. There is this ongoing issue with both distribution and shipping that it's making it difficult for our little niche hobby, and no one is sending containers full of war games over to Europe. So you're talking about shipping 10 copies or 12 copies to a store. It just gets extraordinarily expensive.
I'm always hoping for digital versions of games because they are easier to access for me without having heavy costs on my side. But I know that's not the main focus GMT has or the designers. So that has to be really big numbers and a major success to have a digital version of a game.
If you haven't tried Rally the Troops yet, I highly recommend you check it out. It doesn't have AI, but it does have a variety of games that are available. It does enforce the rules, but you have to find a human being to play with. There are always tons of players available, and you can play asynchronously.
So there's no AI, but you do not need to check if someone's cheating, like in Vassal or something like this, because the rules are in that.
Right, exactly.
Okay, that's also cool.
And 1989 was recently translated over there, so if you haven't played it yet, that's a good place to learn.
Thank you very much. I will visit your recommendation.
For sure.
Alex, so you have the final question you said about Twilight Struggle.
From my side, Jason, also many, many thanks for spending so much time with us for this interview and answering every single of our, I think, over 100 questions meanwhile. It was great fun for us. I hope you also had a little fun with it. And yeah, to finalize the last question on Twilight Struggle, because you also have played a lot of games, is there one card you have in your hand which you would say, that's some card I want to have and looking forward most to have it in my hand? You can pick one for either side.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I love, as a Soviet player, to have decolonization as early as humanly possible, because you just can add so many headaches to the US players' list of problems, and they've already got lots of them in the early war. So then when they're popping up all over the damn place, and you know your mid-war is also going to be bad.
I think that's a very good choice, because if you get it in round one or two, it can reappear in round three.
Exactly. So that one's good. I think the earliest card that can really have an important impact from the U.S. side is de-Stalinization. I really think that part is also an excellent one to have for the U.S. player.
Because Russia doesn't get to play it. But you would say it's better than Marshall Plan in round one or Voice of America?
I mean, who doesn't like having Red Scare in their hand right away? Yeah. Like, that's always... But that's good for both players, honestly. It works equally well. But it might be debilitating if the Russians are able to headline it on turn one, depending on what everybody else's hand looks like.
Yeah.
I don't want three scoring cards in my
hand. You know, it just depends.
Yeah, okay.
I would take the Marshall Plan, but I think the USSR choice is very, very good. I would take the same card. And my favorite card, but not the most powerful one, is the Voice of America. I love that one.
I love Voice of America, too.
That was actually going to be my second choice.
Yeah.
That's the first time someone's asked me that question. I hadn't really thought it through. So those are my knee-jerk reactions.
Nice. Okay. Thank you very much for doing the interview with us. Thank you for having patience. Thank you for answering all the nerdy questions we had. And I was very happy to have you on the show. And yeah, hope to see you maybe if you're doing a Twilight Struggle 2.0.
Fantastic. Thank you guys both. Thank you for all your patience and finally getting this to happen. So that's great.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you very much. Bye.